Out of nowhere, a seagull flew down with a wild cry and seized the Gallivespian in his claw. It was the witch's demon. Lord Roke fought hard, but the bird had him too tightly, and then the witch tore herself from Mrs. Coulter's grasp, snatched the tattered pine branch, and leapt into the air to join her demon. Mrs. Coulter hurled herself towards the bomb, feeling the smoke attack her nose and throat like claws. Tear gas. The soldiers, most of them, had fallen or stumbled away choking. And where had the gas come from, she wondered. But now, as the wind dispersed it, they were beginning to gather themselves again. The great ribbed belly of the Zeppelin bulked over the bomb, straining at its cables in the wind, its silver sides running with moisture. But then a sound from high above made Mrs. Coulter's ears ring, a scream so high and horrified that even the golden monkey clutched her in fear. And a second later, pitching down in a swirl of white limbs, black silk and green twigs, the witch fell right at the feet of Father MacPhail, her bones crunching audibly on the rock. Mrs. Coulter darted forward to see if Lord Roke had survived the fall. But the Gallivespian was dead. His right spur was deep in the witch's neck. The witch herself was still just alive, and her mouth moved shudderingly, saying,
"Something coming. Something else coming."
It made no sense. The president was already stepping over her body to reach the larger cage. His demon was running up and down the sides of the other, her little claws making the silver mesh ring, her voice crying for pity. The golden monkey leapt for Father MacPhail, but not to attack. He scrambled up and over the man's shoulders to reach the complex heart of the wires and the pipework, the resonating chamber. The president tried to grab him, but Mrs. Coulter seized the man's arm and tried to pull him back. She couldn't see. The rain was driving into her eyes, and there was still gas in the air. And all around there was gunfire. What was happening? The floodlights swung in the wind so that nothing seemed steady, not even the black rocks of the mountainside. The president and Mrs. Coulter fought hand to hand, scratching, punching, tearing, pulling, biting, and she was tired and he was strong. But she was desperate, too, and she might have pulled him away, but part of her was watching her demon as he manipulated the handles, his fierce black paws snapping the mechanism this way, that way, pulling, twisting, reaching in. Then came a blow to her temple. She fell stunned, and the president broke free and hauled himself bleeding into the cage, dragging the door shut after him. And the monkey had the chamber open, a glass door on heavy hinges, and he was reaching inside, and there was the lock of hair, held between rubber pads in a metal clasp. Still more to undo, and Mrs. Coulter was hauling herself up with shaking hands. She shook the silvery mesh with all her might, looking up at the blade, the sparking terminals, the man inside. A monkey was unscrewing the clasp, and the president, his face a mask of grim exultation, was twisting wires together. There was a flash of intense white, a lashing crack, and the monkey's form was flung high in the air. With him came a little cloud of gold. Was it Lyra's hair? Was it his own fur? Whatever it was, it blew away at once in the dark. Mrs. Coulter's right hand had convulsed so tightly that it clung to the mesh, leaving her half lying, half hanging, while her head rang and her heart pounded. But something had happened to her sight. A terrible clarity had come over her eyes, the power to see the most tiny details, and they were focused on the one detail in the universe that mattered. Stuck to one of the pads of the clasp in the resonating chamber, there was a single dark gold hair. She cried a great wail of anguish and shook the cage, trying to loosen the hair with the little strength she had left. The president passed his hands over his face, wiping it clear of the rain. His mouth moved as though he was speaking, but she couldn't hear a word. She tore at the mesh, helpless, and then hurled her whole weight against the machine as he brought two wires together with a spark. In utter silence, the brilliant silver blade shot down. Something exploded somewhere, but Mrs. Coulter was beyond feeling it. There were hands lifting her up, Lord Asriel's hands. There was nothing to be surprised at any more. The intention craft stood behind him, poised on the slope and perfectly level. He lifted her in his arms and carried her to the craft, ignoring the gunfire, the billowing smoke, the cries of alarm and confusion.
"Is he dead? Did it go off?"
she managed to say. Lord Asriel climbed in beside her, and the snow leopard leapt in too, the half-stunned monkey in her mouth. Lord Asriel took the controls, and the craft sprang at once into the air. Through pain-dazed eyes, Mrs. Coulter looked down at the mountain slope. Men were running here and there like ants. Some lay dead, while others crawled brokenly over the rocks. The great cable from the generating station snaked down through the chaos, the only purposeful thing in sight, making its way to the glittering bomb, where the president's body lay crumpled inside the cage.
"Lord Roke,"
said Lord Asriel.
"Dead,"
Mrs. Coulter whispered. Lord Asriel pressed a button, and a lance of flame jetted towards the tossing, swaying Zeppelin. An instant later, the whole airship bloomed into a rose of white fire, engulfing the intention craft, which hung motionless and unharmed in the middle of it. Lord Asriel moved the craft unhurriedly away, and they watched as the blazing Zeppelin fell slowly, slowly down on top of the whole scene. Bomb, cable, soldiers and all, and everything began to tumble in a welter of smoke and flames down the mountainside, gathering speed and incinerating the resinous trees as it went, until it plunged into the white waters of the cataract, which whirled it all away into the dark. Lord Asriel touched the controls again, and the intention craft began to speed away northwards. But Mrs. Coulter couldn't take her eyes off the scene. She watched behind them for a long time, gazing with tear-filled eyes at the fire, until it was no more than a vertical line of orange scratched on the dark and wreathed in smoke and steam. And then it was nothing. Chapter 26. The Abyss.
The sun has left his blackness and has found a fresher morning, and the fair moon rejoices in the clear and cloudless night. William Blake.
It was dark, with an enfolding blackness that pressed on Lyra's eyes so heavily that she almost felt the weight of the thousands of tons of rock above them. The only light they had came from the luminous tail of the Lady Salmakia's dragonfly, and even that was fading, for the poor insects had found no food in the world of the dead, and the Chevaliers had died not long before. So while Tialis sat on Will's shoulder, Lyra held the Lady's dragonfly in her hands as the Lady soothed it and whispered to the trembling creature, feeding it first on crumbs of biscuit and then on her own blood. If Lyra had seen her do that, she would have offered hers, since there was more of it. But it was all she could do to concentrate on placing her feet safely and avoiding the lowest parts of the rock above. No Name the Harpy had led them into a system of caves that would bring them, she said, to the nearest point in the world of the dead from which they could open a window to another world. Behind them came the endless column of ghosts. The tunnel was full of whispers, as the foremost encouraged those behind, as the brave urged on the faint-hearted, as the old gave hope to the young.
Is it much further, No Name? Because this poor dragonfly's dying, and then his light'll go out.
The harpy stopped and turned.
Just follow. If you can't see, listen. If you can't hear, feel.
Her eyes shone fierce in the gloom. Lyra nodded.
Yes, I will. But I'm not as strong as I used to be. And I'm not brave. Not very, anyway. Please don't stop. I'll follow you. We all will. Please keep going, No Name.
The harpy turned back and moved on. The dragonfly shine was getting dimmer by the minute, and Lyra knew it would soon be completely gone. But as she stumbled forwards, a voice spoke just beside her, a familiar voice.
Lyra. Lyra, child.
And she turned in delight.
Mr. Scoresby! Oh, I'm so glad to hear you! And it is you! I can see! Just... Oh, I wish I could touch you.
In the faint, faint light, she made out the lean form and the sardonic smile of the Texan aeronaut, and her hand reached forwards of its own accord, in vain.
Me too, honey. But listen to me. They're working some trouble out there, and it's aimed at you. Don't ask me how. Is this the boy with the knife?
Will had been looking at him, eager to see this old companion of Lyra's, but now his eyes went right past Lee to look at the ghost beside him. Lyra saw at once who it was, and marvelled at this grown-up vision of Will, the same jutting jaw, the same way of holding his head. Will was speechless, but his father said,
Listen, there's no time to talk about this. Just do exactly as I say. Take the knife now and find a place where a lock has been cut from Lyra's hair.
His tone was urgent, and Will didn't waste time asking why. Lyra, her eyes wide with alarm, held up the dragonfly with one hand and felt her hair with the other.
No,
said Will.
Take your hand away. I can't see.
And in the faint gleam he could see it. Just above her left temple, there was a little patch of hair that was shorter than the rest.
Who did that? And...
Hush,
said Will, and asked his father's ghost.
What must I do?
Cut the short hair off, right down to her scalp. Collected carefully, every single hair, don't miss even one. Then open another world, any will do, and put the hair through into it, and then close it again. Do it now, at once.
The harpy was watching. The ghosts behind were crowding close. Lyra could see their faint faces in the dimness. Frightened and bewildered, she stood biting her lip while Will did as his father told him, his face close up to the knife point in the paling dragonfly light. He cut a little hollow space in the rock of another world, put all the tiny golden hairs into it, and replaced the rock before closing the window. And then the ground began to shake. From somewhere very deep came a growling, grinding noise, as if the whole center of the earth were turning on itself like a vast mill wheel, and little fragments of stone began to fall from the roof of the tunnel. The ground lurched suddenly to one side. Will seized Lyra's arm, and they clung together as the rock under their feet began to shift and slide, and loose pieces of stone came tumbling past, bruising their legs and feet. The two children, sheltering the Gallivespians, crouched down with their arms over their heads. And then, in a horrible sliding movement, they found themselves being borne away down to the left, and they held each other fiercely, too breathless and shaken even to cry out. Their ears were filled with the roar of thousands of tons of rock tumbling and rolling down with them. Finally, their movement stopped, though all around them smaller rocks were still tumbling and bounding down a slope that hadn't been there a minute before. Lyra was lying on Will's left arm. With his right hand, he felt for the knife. It was still there at his belt.
Tialis, Salmakia.
Both here. Both alive,
said the Chevalier's voice near his ear. The air was full of dust and of the cordite smell of smashed rock. It was hard to breathe and impossible to see. The dragonfly was dead.
Mr. Scoresby? We can't see anything. What happened?
I'm here. I guess the bomb went off, and I guess it missed.
Bomb? Roger, are you there?
Yeah. Mr. Parry, he saved me. I was going to fall, and he caught hold.
Look, said the ghost to John Parry, but hold still to the rock and don't move.
The dust was clearing, and from somewhere there was light, a strange faint golden glimmer like a luminous misty rain falling all around them. It was enough to strike their hearts ablaze with fear, for it lit up what lay to their left, the place into which it was all falling, or flowing, like a river over the edge of a waterfall. It was a vast black emptiness, like a shaft into the deepest darkness. The golden light flowed into it and died. They could see the other side, but it was much farther away than Will could have thrown a stone. To their right, a slope of rough stones, loose and precariously balanced, rose high into the dusty gloom. The children and their companions were clinging to what was not even a ledge, just some lucky hand and footholds, on the edge of that abyss. And there was no way out except forward, along the slope, among the shattered rocks and the teetering boulders which, it seemed, the slightest touch would send hurtling down below. And behind them, as the dust cleared, more and more of the ghosts were gazing in horror at the abyss. They were crouching on the slope, too frightened to move. Only the harpies were unafraid. They took to their wings and soared above, scanning backward and forward, flying back to reassure those still in the tunnel, flying ahead to search for the way out. Lyra checked. At least the alethiometer was safe. Suppressing her fear, she looked around, found Roger's little face, and said,
Come on, then. We're all still here. We haven't been hurt. And we can see now, at least. So just keep going. Just keep on moving. We can't go any other way than round the edge of this.
She gestured at the abyss.
So we just got to keep going ahead. I swear Will and me'll just keep on till we do. So don't be scared. Don't give up. Don't lag behind. Tell the others. I can't look back all the time because I got to watch where I'm going. So I got to trust you to come on steady after us, all right?
The little ghost nodded. And so, in a shocked silence, the column of the dead began their journey along the edge of the abyss. How long it took, neither Lyra nor Will could guess. How fearful and dangerous it was, they were never able to forget. The darkness below was so profound that it seemed to pull the eyesight down into it, and a ghastly dizziness swam over their minds when they looked. Whenever they could, they looked ahead of them fixedly, on this rock, that foothold, this projection, that loose slope of gravel, and kept their eyes from the gulf. But it pulled, it tempted, and they couldn't help glancing into it, only to feel their balance tilting and their eyesight swimming and a dreadful nausea gripping their throats. From time to time, the living ones looked back and saw the infinite line of the dead winding out of the crack they'd come through. Mothers pressing their infants' faces to their breasts. Aged fathers clambering slowly. Little children clutching the skirts of the person in front. Young boys and girls of Roger's age keeping staunch and careful. So many of them. And all following Will and Lyra, so they still hoped, towards the open air. But some didn't trust them. They crowded close behind, and both children felt cold hands on their hearts and their entrails, and they heard vicious whispers.
Where is the upper world? How much further?
We're frightened here. We should never have come. At least back in the world of the dead we had a little light and a little company. This is far worse.
You did a wrong thing when you came to our land. You should have stayed in your own world and waited to die before you came down to disturb us.
By what right are you leading us? You are only children. Who gave you the authority?
Will wanted to turn and denounce them, but Lyra held his arm. They were unhappy and frightened, she said. Then the Lady Salmakia spoke, and her clear, calm voice carried a long way in the great emptiness.
Friends, be brave. Stay together and keep going. The way is hard, but Lyra can find it. Be patient and cheerful, and we'll lead you out. Don't fear.
Lyra felt herself strengthened by hearing this, and that was really the lady's intention. And so they toiled on, with painful effort.
Will, can you hear that wind?
Yes, I can, but I can't feel it at all. And I tell you something about that hole down there. It's the same kind of thing as when I cut a window, the same kind of edge. There's something special about that kind of edge. Once you've felt it, you never forget it. And I can see it there, just where the rock falls away into the dark. But that big space down there, that's not another world like all the others. It's different. I don't like it. I wish I could close it up.
You haven't closed every window you've made.
No, because I couldn't some of them. But I know I should. Things go wrong if they're left open, and one that big.
He gestured downwards, not wanting to look.
It's wrong. Something bad will happen.
While they were talking together, another conversation had been taking place a little way off. The Chevalier Tialis was talking quietly with the ghosts of Lee Scoresby and John Parry.
So what are you saying, John?
Said Lee.
You're saying we ought not to go out into the open air? Man, every single part of me is aching to join the rest of the living universe again.
Yes, and so am I,
said Will's father.
But I believe that if those of us who are used to fighting could manage to hold ourselves back, we might be able to throw ourselves into the battle on Azrael's side. And if it came at the right moment, it might make all the difference.
Ghosts,
said Tialis, trying to hold the skepticism from his voice and failing.
How could you fight?
We couldn't hurt living creatures, that's quite true. But Azrael's army is going to contend with other kinds of being as well.
Those spectres.
Just what I was thinking. They make for the demon, don't they? And our demons are long gone. It's worth a try, Lee.
Well, I'm with you, my friend.
And you, sir,
said John Parry's ghost to the Chevalier.
I have spoken to the ghosts of your people. Will you live long enough to see the world again before you die and come back as a ghost?
It's true. Our lives are short compared to yours. I have a few days more to live, and the Lady Salmakia a little longer, perhaps. But thanks to what those children are doing, our exile as ghosts will not be permanent. I have been proud to help them.
They moved on, and that abominable fall yawned all the time, and one little slip, one footstep on a loose rock, one careless handhold would send you down forever and ever, thought Lyra. So far down you'd die of starvation before you ever hit the bottom, and then your poor ghost would go on falling and falling into an infinite gulf, with no one to help, no hands to reach down and lift you out, forever conscious and forever falling. Oh, that would be far worse than the grey, silent world they were leaving, wouldn't it? A strange thing happened to her mind then. The thought of falling induced a kind of vertigo in Lyra, and she swayed. Will was ahead of her, just too far to reach, or she might have taken his hand. But at that moment she was more conscious of Roger, and a little flicker of vanity blazed up for a moment in her heart. There'd been an occasion once on Jordan College roof when, just to frighten him, she defied her vertigo and walked along the edge of the stone gutter. She looked back to remind him of it now. She was Roger's Lyra, full of grace and daring. She didn't need to creep along like an insect. But the little boy's whispering voice said,
Lyra, be careful. Remember, you ain't dead like us.
And it seemed to happen so slowly, but there was nothing she could do. Her weight shifted, the stones moved under her feet, and helplessly she began to slide. In the first moment it was annoying, and then it was comic. How silly, she thought. But as she utterly failed to hold on to anything, as the stones rolled and tumbled beneath her, as she slid down towards the edge, gathering speed, the horror of it slammed into her. She was going to fall. There was nothing to stop her. It was already too late. Her body convulsed with terror. She wasn't aware of the ghosts who flung themselves down to try and catch her, only to find her hurtling through them like a stone through mist. She didn't know that Will was yelling her name so loudly that the abyss resounded with it. Instead, her whole being was a vortex of roaring fear. Faster and faster she tumbled, down and down, and some ghosts couldn't bear to watch. They hid their eyes and cried aloud. Will felt electric with fear. He watched in anguish as Lyra slid farther and farther, knowing he could do nothing and knowing he had to watch. He couldn't hear the desperate wail he was uttering any more than she could. Another 2 seconds, another second. She was at the edge. She couldn't stop. She was there. She was falling. And out of the dark swooped that creature whose claws had raked her scalp not long before. No name, the harpy, woman-faced, bird-winged, and those same claws closed tight around the girl's wrist. Together they plunged on down, the extra weight almost too much for the harpy's strong wings, but they beat and beat and beat, and her claws held firm, and slowly, heavily, the harpy carried the child up and up out of the gulf and brought her limp and fainting to Will's reaching arms. He held her tight, pressing her to his chest, feeling the wild beat of her heart against his ribs. She wasn't Lyra just then, and he wasn't Will. She wasn't a girl, and he wasn't a boy. They were the only two human beings in that vast gulf of death. They clung together, and the ghosts clustered around, whispering comfort, blessing the harpy. Closest at hand were Will's father and Lee Scoresby, and how they longed to hold her too. Antialis and Salmakia spoke to no name, praising her, calling her the saviour of them all, generous one, blessing her kindness. As soon as Lyra could move, she reached out trembling for the harpy and put her arms around her neck, kissing and kissing her ravaged face. She couldn't speak. All the words, all the confidence, all the vanity had been shaken out of her. They lay still for some minutes. Once the terror had begun to subside, they set off again, Will holding Lyra's hand tightly in his good one. They crept forward, testing each spot before they put any weight on it, a process so slow and wearisome that they thought they might die of fatigue. But they couldn't rest. They couldn't stop. How could anyone rest with that fearful gulf below them? And after another hour of toil, he said to her,
Look ahead. I think there's a way out.
It was true. The slope was getting easier, and it was even possible to climb slightly up and away from the edge. And ahead, wasn't that a fold in the wall of the cliff? Could that really be a way out? Lyra looked into Will's brilliant, strong eyes and smiled. They clambered on, up and further up, with every step moving further from the abyss. And as they climbed, they found the ground firmer, the handholds more secure, the footholds less liable to roll and twist their ankles.
We must have climbed a fair way now. I could try the knife and see what I find.
Not yet. Farther to go yet. This is a bad place to open. Better place, higher up.
They carried on quietly. Hand, foot, wait, move, test, hand, foot. Their fingers were raw, their knees and hips were trembling with the effort, their heads ached and rang with exhaustion. They climbed the last few feet up to the foot of the cliff, where a narrow defile led a little way into the shadow. Lyra watched with aching eyes as Will took the knife and began to search the air, touching, withdrawing, searching, touching again.
Ah!
You found an open space!
I think so.
Will,
said his father's ghost.
Stop a moment. Listen to me.
Will put down the knife and turned. In all the effort, he hadn't been able to think of his father, but it was good to know he was there. Suddenly, he realized that they were going to part for the last time.
What will happen when you go outside? Will you just vanish?
Not yet. Mr. Scoresby and I have an idea. Some of us will remain here for a little while. And we shall need you to let us into Lord Asriel's world, because he might need our help. What's more,
he went on somberly, looking at Lyra,
You'll need to travel there yourselves if you want to find your demons again, because that's where they've gone.
But, Mr. Parry, how do you know our demons have gone into my father's world?
I was a shaman when I was alive. I learned how to see things. Ask your alethiometer, it'll confirm what I say. But remember this about demons. The man you knew was Sir Charles Latram had to return to his own world periodically. He could not live permanently in mine. The philosophers of the Guild of the Torre degli Angeli, who travelled between worlds for 300 years or more, found the same thing to be true. And gradually their world weakened and decayed as a result. And then there is what happened to me. I was a soldier. I was an officer in the Marines. And then I earned my living as an explorer. I was as fit and healthy as it's possible for a human to be. Then I walked out of my own world by accident and couldn't find the way back. I did many things and learned a great deal in the world I found myself in, but 10 years after I arrived there, I was mortally sick. And this is the reason for all those things. Your demon can only live its full life in the world it was born in. Elsewhere, it will eventually sicken and die. We can travel if there are openings into other worlds, but we can only live in our own. Lord Asriel's great enterprise will fail in the end for the same reason. We have to build the Republic of Heaven where we are, because for us, there is no elsewhere. Will, my boy, you and Lyra can go out now for a brief rest. You need that, and you deserve it. But then you must come back into the dark with me and Mr. Scoresby for one last journey.
Will and Lyra exchanged a look. Then he cut a window, and it was the sweetest thing they had ever seen. The night air filled their lungs, fresh and clean and cool. Their eyes took in a canopy of dazzling stars and the shine of water somewhere below, and here and there groves of great trees, as high as castles, dotting the wide savannah. Will enlarged the window as wide as he could, moving across the grass to left and right, making it big enough for 6, 7, 8 to walk through abreast, out of the land of the dead. The first ghosts trembled with hope, and their excitement passed back like a ripple over the long line behind them, young children and aged parents alike looking up and ahead with delight and wonder as the first stars they had seen for centuries shone through into their poor, starved eyes. The first ghost to leave the world of the dead was Roger. He took a step forward and turned to look back at Lyra, and laughed in surprise as he found himself turning into the night, the starlight, the air. And then he was gone, leaving behind such a vivid little burst of happiness that Will was reminded of the bubbles in a glass of champagne. The other ghosts followed Roger, and Will and Lyra fell exhausted on the dew-laden grass, every nerve in their bodies blessing the sweetness of the good soil, the night air, the stars. Chapter 27. The Platform.
My soul into the boughs does glide. There like a bird it sits and sings, then whets and combs its silver wings. Andrew Marvel.
Once the Mulefa began to build the platform for Mary, they worked quickly and well. She enjoyed watching them because they could discuss without quarrelling and cooperate without getting in each other's way, and because their techniques of splitting and cutting and joining wood were so elegant and effective. Within 2 days, the observation platform was designed and built and lifted into place. It was firm and spacious and comfortable, and when she had climbed up to it, she was as happy, in one way, as she had ever been. That one way was physically. In the dense green of the canopy, with the rich blue of the sky between the leaves, with a breeze keeping her skin cool and the faint scent of the flowers delighting her whenever she sensed it, with the rustle of the leaves, the song of the hundreds of birds, and the distant murmur of the waves on the seashore, all her senses were lulled and nurtured, and if she could have stopped thinking, she would have been entirely lapped in bliss. But of course, thinking was what she was there for. And when she looked through her spyglass and saw the relentless outward drift of the Sraf, the shadow particles, it seemed to her as if happiness and life and hope were drifting away with them. She could find no explanation at all. 300 years, the Mulefa had said. That was how long the trees had been failing. Given that the shadow particles passed through all the worlds alike, Presumably the same thing was happening in her universe, too, and in every other one. 300 years ago, the Royal Society was set up, the first true scientific society in her world. Newton was making his discoveries about optics and gravitation. 300 years ago in Lyra's world, someone invented the alethiometer. At the same time, in that strange world through which she'd come to get here, the subtle knife was invented. She lay back on the planks, feeling the platform move in a very slight, very slow rhythm as the great tree swayed in the sea breeze. Holding the spyglass to her eye, she watched the myriad tiny sparkles drift through the leaves, past the open mouths of the blossoms, through the massive boughs, moving against the wind, in a slow, deliberate current that looked all but conscious. What had happened 300 years ago? Was it the cause of the dust current, or was it the other way around? Or were they both the results of a different cause altogether? Or were they simply not connected at all? The drift was mesmerizing. How easy it would be to fall into a trance and let her mind drift away with the floating particles. Before she knew what she was doing, and because her body was lulled, that was exactly what happened. She suddenly snapped awake to find herself outside her body, and she panicked. She was a little way above the platform and a few feet off among the branches, and something had happened to the dust wind. Instead of that slow drift, it was racing like a river in flood. Had it sped up, or was time moving differently for her now that she was outside her body? Either way, she was conscious of the most horrible danger, because the flood was threatening to sweep her loose completely, and it was immense. She flung out her arms to seize hold of anything solid, but she had no arms. Nothing connected. Now she was almost over that abominable drop, and her body was further and further from reach, sleeping so hoggishly below her. She tried to shout and wake herself up. Not a sound. The body slumbered on, and the self that observed was being borne away out of the canopy of leaves altogether and into the open sky. And no matter how she struggled, she could make no headway. The force that carried her out was as smooth and powerful as water pouring over a weir. The particles of dust were streaming along as if they, too, were pouring over some invisible edge, and carrying her away from her body. She flung a mental lifeline to that physical self and tried to recall the feeling of being in it, all the sensations that made up being alive. The exact touch of her friend Atal's soft-tipped trunk caressing her neck, the taste of bacon and eggs, the triumphant strain in her muscles as she pulled herself up a rock face, the delicate dancing of her fingers on a computer keyboard, the smell of roasting coffee, the warmth of her bed on a winter night. And gradually she stopped moving. The lifeline held fast, and she felt the weight and strength of the current pushing against her as she hung there in the sky. And then a strange thing happened. Little by little, as she reinforced those sense memories, adding others, tasting an iced margarita in California, sitting under the lemon trees outside a restaurant in Lisbon, scraping the frost off the windshield of her car, she felt the dust wind easing. The pressure was lessening. But only on her, all around, above and below, the great flood was streaming as fast as ever. Somehow there was a little patch of stillness around her where the particles were resisting the flow. They were conscious. They felt her anxiety and responded to it, and they began to carry her back to her deserted body, and when she was close enough to see it once more, so heavy, so warm, so safe, a silent sob convulsed her heart. And then she sank back into her body and awoke. She took in a shuddering, deep breath. She pressed her hands and her legs against the rough planks of the platform, and having a minute ago nearly gone mad with fear, she was now suffused with a deep, slow ecstasy at being one with her body and the earth and everything that was matter. Finally, she sat up and tried to take stock. Her fingers found the spyglass, and she held it to her eye, supporting one trembling hand with the other. There was no doubt about it. That slow, sky-wide drift had become a flood. There was nothing to hear and nothing to feel, and without the spyglass, nothing to see. But even when she took the glass from her eye, the sense of that swift, silent inundation remained vividly, together with something she hadn't noticed in the terror of being outside her body, the profound, helpless regret that was abroad in the air. The shadow particles knew what was happening and were sorrowful. And she herself was partly shadow matter. Part of her was subject to this tide that was moving through the cosmos. And so were the Mulefa, and so were human beings in every world, and every kind of conscious creature wherever they were. And unless she found out what was happening, they might all find themselves drifting away to oblivion. Everyone. Suddenly she longed for the earth again. She put the spyglass in her pocket and began the long climb down to the ground. Father Gomez stepped through the window as the evening light lengthened and mellowed. He saw the great stands of wheel trees and the roads lacing through the prairie, just as Mary had done from the same spot some time before. But the air was free of haze, for it had rained a little earlier, and he could see farther than she had. In particular, he could see the glimmer of a distant sea and some flickering white shapes that might be sails. He lifted the rucksack higher on his shoulders and turned towards them to see what he could find. In the calm of the long evening, it was pleasant to walk on this smooth road, with the sound of some cicada-like creatures in the long grass and the setting sun warm in his face. The air was fresh, too, clear and sweet and entirely free of the taint of naphtha fumes, kerosene fumes, whatever they were, which had lain so heavily on the air in one of the worlds he'd passed through, the world his target, the tempter herself, belonged to. He came out at sunset on a little headland beside a shallow bay. If they had tides in this sea, the tide was high, because there was only a narrow fringe of soft white sand above the water. And floating in the calm bay were a dozen or more... Father Gomez had to stop and think carefully. A dozen or more enormous snow-white birds, each the size of a rowboat, with long straight wings that trailed on the water behind them. Very long wings, at least 2 yards in length. Were they birds? They had feathers and heads and beaks not unlike swans, but those wings were situated one in front of the other, surely. Suddenly they saw him. Heads turned with a snap, and at once all those wings were raised high, exactly like the sails of a yacht, and they all leaned in with the breeze, making for the shore. Father Gomez was impressed by the beauty of those wing sails, by how they were flexed and trimmed so perfectly, and by the speed of the birds. Then he saw that they were paddling, too. They had legs under the water, placed not fore and aft like the wings, but side by side, and with the wings and the legs together they had an extraordinary speed and grace in the water. As the first one reached the shore, it lumbered up through the dry sand, making directly for the priest. It was hissing with malice, stabbing its head forward as it waddled heavily up the shore, and the beak snapped and clacked. There were teeth in the beak, too, like a series of sharp, incurved hooks. Father Gomez was about 100 yards from the edge of the water, on a low, grassy promontory, and he had plenty of time to put down his rucksack, take out the rifle, load, aim, and fire. The bird's head exploded in a mist of red and white, and the creature blundered on clumsily for several steps before sinking onto its breast. It didn't die for a minute or more. The legs kicked, the wings rose and fell, and the great bird beat itself around and around in a bloody circle, kicking up the rough grass, until a long, bubbling expiration from its lungs ended with a coughing spray of red, and it fell still. The other birds had stopped as soon as the first one fell, and stood watching it, and watching the man, too. There was a quick, ferocious intelligence in their eyes. They looked from him to the dead bird, from that to the rifle, from the rifle to his face. He raised the rifle to his shoulder again and saw them react, shifting backwards clumsily, crowding together. They understood. They were fine, strong creatures, large and broad-backed, like living boats, in fact. If they knew what death was, thought Father Gomez, and if they could see the connection between death and himself, then there was the basis of a fruitful understanding between them. Once they had truly learned to fear him, they would do exactly as he said. Chapter 28. Midnight.
For many a time I have been half in love with easeful death. John Keats.
Lord Asriel said,
Marisa, wake up. We're about to land.
A blustery dawn was breaking over the basalt fortress as the intention craft flew in from the south. Mrs. Coulter, sore and heartsick, opened her eyes. She had not been asleep. She could see the angel Zafania gliding above the landing ground, and then rising and wheeling up to the tower as the craft made for the ramparts. As soon as the craft had landed, Lord Asriel leapt out and ran to join King Ogunwe on the western watchtower, ignoring Mrs. Coulter entirely. The technicians who came at once to attend to the flying machine took no notice of her either. No one questioned her about the loss of the aircraft she'd stolen. It was as if she'd become invisible. She made her way sadly up to the room in the adamant tower, where the orderly offered to bring her some food and coffee.
Whatever you have, and thank you. Oh, by the way,
she went on as the man turned to go,
Lord Asriel's alethiometrist, Mr.
Mr. Basilides?
Yes. Is he free to come here for a moment?
He's working with his books at the moment, ma'am. I'll ask him to step up here when he can.
She washed and changed into the one clean shirt she had left. The cold wind that shook the windows and the grey morning light made her shiver. She put some more coals on the iron stove, hoping it would stop her trembling, but the cold was in her bones, not just her flesh. 10 minutes later, there was a knock on the door. The pale, dark-eyed alethiometrist, with his nightingale demon on his shoulder, came in and bowed slightly. A moment later, the orderly arrived with a tray of bread, cheese and coffee, and Mrs. Coulter said,
"Thank you for coming, Mr. Basilides. May I offer you some refreshment?"
"I will take some coffee, thank you."
"Please tell me,"
she said as soon as she'd poured the drink.
"Because I'm sure you've been following what's happened. Is my daughter alive?"
He hesitated. The golden monkey clutched her arm.
"She is alive, but also..."
"Yes. Oh, please, what do you mean?"
"She is in the world of the dead. For some time I could not interpret what the instrument was telling me. It seemed impossible. But there is no doubt. She and the boy have gone into the world of the dead, and they have opened a way for the ghosts to come out. As soon as the dead reach the open, they dissolve, as their demons did, and it seems that this is the most sweet and desirable end for them. And the alethiometer tells me that the girl did this because she overheard a prophecy that there would come an end to death, and she thought that this was a task for her to accomplish. As a result, there is now a way out of the world of the dead."
Mrs. Coulter couldn't speak. She had to turn away and go to the window to conceal the emotion on her face. Finally, she said,
"And will she come out alive? But no, I know you can't predict. Is she... how is she? Has she..."
"She is suffering. She is in pain. She is afraid. But she has the companionship of the boy and of the two Gallivespian spies, and they are still all together."
"And the bomb?"
"The bomb did not hurt her."
Mrs. Coulter felt suddenly exhausted. She wanted nothing more than to lie down and sleep for months, for years. Outside, the flag ropes snapped and clattered in the wind, and the rooks cawed as they wheeled around the ramparts.
"Thank you, sir. I'm very grateful. Please, would you let me know if you discover anything more about her, or where she is, or what she's doing?"
The man bowed and left. Mrs. Coulter went to lie down on the camp bed, but try as she would, she couldn't keep her eyes closed.
"What do you make of that, King?"
said Lord Asriel. He was looking through the watchtower telescope at something in the western sky. It had the appearance of a mountain hanging in the sky a hand's breadth above the horizon and covered in cloud. It was a very long way off, so far, in fact, that it was no bigger than a thumbnail held out at arm's length. But it had not been there for long, and it hung there absolutely still. The telescope brought it closer, but there was no more detail. Cloud still looks like cloud, however much it's magnified.
"The clouded mountain,"
said Ogunwe.
"Or, what do they call it? The chariot."
"With the regent at the reins. He's concealed himself well, this Metatron. They speak of him in the apocryphal scriptures. He was a man once, a man called Enoch, the son of Jared, 6 generations away from Adam. And now he rules the kingdom. And he's intending to do more than that, if that angel they found by the Sulphur Lake was correct, the one who entered the Clouded Mountain to spy. If he wins this battle, he intends to intervene directly in human life. Imagine that, Ogunwe. A permanent inquisition, worse than anything the consistorial court of discipline could dream up, staffed by spies and traitors in every world, and directed personally by the intelligence that's keeping that mountain aloft. The old authority at least had the grace to withdraw. The dirty work of burning heretics and hanging witches was left to his priests. This new one will be far, far worse."
"Well, he's begun by invading the Republic. Look, is that smoke?"
A drift of grey was leaving the clouded mountain, a slowly spreading smudge against the blue sky. But it couldn't have been smoke. It was drifting against the wind that tore at the clouds. The king put his field glasses to his eyes and saw what it was.
"Angels."
Lord Asriel came away from the telescope and stood up, hands shading his eyes. In hundreds, and then thousands, and tens of thousands, until half that part of the sky was darkened. The minute figures flew and flew and kept on coming. Lord Asriel had seen the billion-strong flocks of blue starlings that wheeled at sunset around the palace of the Emperor Kang Po, but he had never seen so vast a multitude in all his life. The flying beings gathered themselves and then streamed away slowly, slowly, to the north and the south.
Ah, and what's that?
Said Lord Asriel, pointing.
That's not the wind.
The cloud was swirling on the southern flank of the mountain, and long, tattered banners of vapour streamed out in the powerful winds. But Lord Asriel was right. The movement was coming from within, not from the air outside. The cloud roiled and tumbled, and then it parted for a second. There was more than a mountain there, but they only saw it for a moment, and then the cloud swirled back, as if drawn across by an unseen hand, to conceal it again. King Ogunwe put down his field glasses.
That's not a mountain. I saw gun emplacements.
So did I. A whole complexity of things. Can he see out through the cloud, I wonder? In some worlds, they have machines to do that. But as for his army, if those angels are all they've got...
The king gave a brief exclamation, half of astonishment, half of despair. Lord Asriel turned and gripped his arm with fingers that all but bruised him to the bone.
They haven't got this.
He shook Ogunwe's arm violently.
They haven't got flesh.
He laid his hand against his friend's rough cheek.
Few as we are, and short-lived as we are, and weak-sighted as we are, in comparison with them, we're still stronger. They envy us, Ogunwe. That's what fuels their hatred, I'm sure of it. They long to have our precious bodies, so solid and powerful, so well adapted to the good earth. And if we drive at them with force and determination, we can sweep aside those infinite numbers as you can sweep your hand through mist. They have no more power than that.
Asriel, they have allies from a thousand worlds, living beings like us.
We shall win.
And suppose he sent those angels to look for your daughter.
My daughter! Isn't it something to bring a child like that into the world? You'd think it was enough to go alone to the King of the Armored Bears and trick his kingdom out of his paws, but to go down into the world of the dead and calmly let them all out? And that boy, I want to meet that boy. I want to shake his hand. Did we know what we were taking on when we started this rebellion? No. But did they know, the Authority and his regent, this Metatron? Did they know what they were taking on when my daughter got involved?
Lord Asriel, do you understand her importance for the future?
Frankly, no. That's why I want to see Basilides. Where did he go?
To the Lady Coulter. But the man is worn out. He can do no more until he's rested.
He should have rested before. Send for him, would you? Oh, one more thing. Please ask Madame Oxentil to come to the tower as soon as it's convenient. I must give her my condolences.
Madame Oxentil had been the Gallivespian's second in command. Now she would have to take over Lord Roke's responsibilities. King Ogunwe bowed and left his commander scanning the grey horizon. All through that day the army assembled. Angels of Lord Asriel's force flew high over the clouded mountain, looking for an opening, but without success. Nothing changed. No more angels flew out or inward. The high winds tore at the clouds, and the clouds endlessly renewed themselves, not parting even for a second. The sun crossed the cold blue sky and then moved down to the southwest, gilding the clouds and tinting the vapour around the mountain every shade of cream and scarlet, of apricot and orange. When the sun sank, the clouds glowed faintly from within. Warriors were now in place from every world where Lord Asriel's rebellion had supporters. Mechanics and artificers were fueling aircraft, loading weapons, and calibrating sights and measures. As the darkness came, some welcome reinforcements arrived. Padding silently over the cold ground from the north, separately, singly, came a number of armored bears. A large number, and among them was their king. Not long afterwards there arrived the first of several witch clans, the sound of the air through their pine branches whispering in the dark sky for a long time. Along the plain to the south of the fortress glimmered thousands of lights, marking the camps of those who had arrived from far off. Farther away, in all four corners of the compass, flights of spy angels cruised tirelessly, keeping watch. At midnight in the Adamant Tower, Lord Asriel sat in discussion with King Ogunwe, the angel Zephania, Madame Oxentil the Gallivespian, and Teucros Basilides. The alethiometrist had just finished speaking, and Lord Asriel stood up, crossed to the window and looked out at the distant glow of the clouded mountain hanging in the western sky. The others were silent. They had just heard something that had made Lord Asriel turn pale and tremble, and none of them quite knew how to respond. Finally, Lord Asriel spoke.
Mr. Basilides, you must be very fatigued. I am grateful for all your efforts. Please take some wine with us.
Thank you, my lord,
said the reader. His hands were shaking. King Ugunwe poured the golden tokay and handed him the glass.
What will this mean, Lord Asriel?
Said Madame Oxenteel. Lord Asriel came back to the table.
Well, it will mean that when we join battle, we shall have a new objective. My daughter and this boy have become separated from their demons somehow, and managed to survive. And their demons are somewhere in this world. Correct me if I'm summarizing wrongly, Mr. Basilides. Their demons are in this world, and Metatron is intent on capturing them. If he captures their demons, the children will have to follow. And if he can control those two children, the future is his, forever. Our task is clear. We have to find the demons before he does, and keep them safe till the girl and the boy rejoin them.
What form do they have, these two lost demons?
They are not yet fixed, madame. They might be any shape.
So, to sum it up, all of us, our republic, the future of every conscious being, we all depend on my daughter's remaining alive and on keeping her demon and the boys out of the hands of Metatron?
That is so.
Lord Asriel sighed, almost with satisfaction. It was as if he'd come to the end of a long and complex calculation and reached an answer that made quite unexpected sense.
Very well,
he said, spreading his hands wide on the table.
Then this is what we shall do when the battle begins. King Ugunwe, you will assume command of all the armies defending the fortress. Madame Oxenteel, you are to send your people out at once to search in every direction for the girl and the boy and the two demons. When you find them, guard them with your lives until they come together again. At that point, I understand, the boy will be able to help them escape to another world and safety.
The lady nodded. Her stiff grey hair caught the lamplight, glinting like stainless steel, and the blue hawk she had inherited from Lord Roke spread his wings briefly on the bracket by the door.
Now, Zephania, what do you know of this Metatron? He was once a man. Does he still have the physical strength of a human being?
He came to prominence long after I was exiled,
the angel said.
I have never seen him up close, but he would not have been able to dominate the kingdom unless he was very strong indeed, strong in every way. Most angels would avoid fighting hand to hand. Metatron would relish the combat and win.
Ugunwe could tell that Lord Asriel had been struck by an idea. His attention suddenly withdrew, his eyes lost focus for an instant, and then snapped back to the moment with an extra charge of intensity.
I see. Finally, Zephania, Mr. Basilides tells us that their bomb not only opened an abyss below the worlds, but also fractured the structure of things so profoundly that there are fissures and cracks everywhere. Somewhere nearby, there must be a way down to the edge of that abyss. I want you to look for it.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to destroy Metatron. But my part is nearly over. It's my daughter who has to live. And it's our task to keep all the forces of the kingdom away from her so that she has a chance to find her way to a safer world. She and that boy, and their demons.
And what about Mrs. Coulter?
Lord Asriel passed a hand over his forehead.
I would not have her troubled. Leave her alone and protect her if you can. Although, well, maybe I'm doing her an injustice. Whatever else she's done, she's never failed to surprise me. But we all know what we must do, and why we must do it. We have to protect Lyra until she has found her demon and escaped. Our republic might have come into being for the sole purpose of helping her do that. Let us do it as well as we can.
Mrs. Coulter lay in Lord Asriel's bed next door. Hearing voices in the other room, she stirred, for she wasn't deeply asleep. She came out of her troubled slumber, uneasy and heavy with longing. Her demon sat up beside her, but she didn't want to move closer to the door. It was simply the sound of Lord Asriel's voice she wanted to hear, rather than any particular words. She thought they were both doomed. She thought they were all doomed. Finally, she heard the door closing in the other room, and roused herself to stand up.
Asriel,
she said, going through into the warm naphtha light. His demon growled softly. The golden monkey dropped his head low to propitiate her. Lord Asriel was rolling up a large map and did not turn.
Asriel, what will happen to us all?
She said, taking a chair. He pressed the heels of his hands into his eyes. His face was ravaged with fatigue. He sat down and rested an elbow on the table. Their demons were very still, the monkey crouching on the chair back, the snow leopard sitting upright and alert at Lord Asriel's side, watching Mrs. Coulter unblinkingly.
You didn't hear?
I heard a little. I couldn't sleep, but I wasn't listening. Where is Lyra now? Does anyone know?
No.
He still hadn't answered her first question, and he wasn't going to, and she knew it.
We should have married and brought her up ourselves.
It was such an unexpected remark that he blinked. His demon uttered the softest possible growl at the back of her throat and settled down with her paws outstretched in the manner of the Sphinx. He said nothing.
I can't bear the thought of oblivion, Asriel. Sooner anything than that. I used to think pain would be worse. To be tortured forever, I thought that must be worse. But as long as you were conscious, it would be better, wouldn't it? Better than feeling nothing, just going into the dark, everything going out forever and ever.
His part was simply to listen. His eyes were locked on hers and he was paying profound attention. There was no need to respond.
The other day, when you spoke about her so bitterly and about me, I thought you hated her. I could understand your hating me. I've never hated you. But I could understand. I could see why you might hate me. But I couldn't see why you hated Lyra.
He turned his head away slowly and then looked back.
I remember you said something strange on Svalbard, on the mountaintop, just before you left our world. You said, "Come with me and we'll destroy dust forever." You remember saying that? But you didn't mean it. You meant the very opposite, didn't you? I see now. Why didn't you tell me what you were really doing? Why didn't you tell me you were really trying to preserve dust? You could have told me the truth.
I wanted you to come and join me, and I thought you would prefer a lie.
Yes, that's what I thought.
She couldn't sit still, but she didn't really have the strength to stand up. For a moment she felt faint, her head swam, sounds receded, the room darkened. But almost at once her senses came back even more pitilessly than before, and nothing in the situation had changed.
Asriel,
she murmured. The golden monkey put a tentative hand out to touch the paw of the snow leopard. The man watched without a word, and Stelmaria didn't move. Her eyes were fixed on Mrs. Coulter.
Oh, Asriel, what will happen to us? Is this the end of everything?
He said nothing. Moving like someone in a dream, she got to her feet, picked up the rucksack that lay in the corner of the room, and reached inside it for her pistol. And what she would have done next, no one knew, because at that moment there came the sound of footsteps running up the stairs. Both man and woman, and both demons, turned to look at the orderly who came in and said breathlessly,
"Excuse me, my lord. The two demons. They've been seen, not far from the eastern gate, in the form of cats. The sentry tried to talk to them, bring them inside, but they wouldn't come near. It was only a minute or so ago."
Lord Asriel sat up, transfigured. All the fatigue had been wiped off his face in a moment. He sprang to his feet and seized his greatcoat. Ignoring Mrs. Coulter, he flung the coat around his shoulders and said to the orderly,
"Tell Madame Oxenteel at once. Put this order out. The demons are not to be threatened or frightened or coerced in any way. Anyone seeing them should first..."
Mrs. Coulter heard no more of what he was saying because he was already halfway down the stairs. When his running footsteps had faded too, the only sounds were the gentle hiss of the naphtha lamp and the moan of the wild wind outside. Her eyes found the eyes of her demon. The golden monkey's expression was as subtle and complex as it had ever been in all their 35 years of life.
"Very well. I can't see any other way. I think we'll..."
He knew at once what she meant. He leapt to her breast and they embraced. Then she found her fur-lined coat, and they very quietly left the chamber and made their way down the dark stairs. Chapter 29. The Battle on the Plain.
Each man is in his spectre's power until the arrival of that hour when his humanity awake. William Blake.
It was desperately hard for Lyra and Will to leave that sweet world where they had slept the night before, but if they were ever going to find their demons, they knew they had to go into the dark once more. And now, after hours of weary crawling through the dim tunnel, Lyra bent over the alethiometer for the 20th time, making little unconscious sounds of distress, whimpers and catches of breath that would have been sobs if they were any stronger. Will, too, felt the pain where his demon had been, a scalded place of acute tenderness that every breath tore at with cold hooks. How wearily Lyra turned the wheels. On what leaden feet her thoughts moved. The ladders of meaning that led from every one of the alethiometer's 36 symbols, down which she used to move so lightly and confidently, felt loose and shaky. And holding the connections between them in her mind, it had once been like running or singing or telling a story, something natural. Now she had to do it laboriously, and her grip was failing. And she mustn't fail, because otherwise everything would fail.
It's not far, and there's all kinds of danger. There's a battle. But we're nearly in the right place now. Just at the end of this tunnel, there's a big smooth rock running with water. You cut through there.
The ghosts who were going to fight pressed forwards eagerly, and she felt Lee Scoresby close at her side.
Lyra, gal, it won't be long now. When you see that old bear, you tell him Lee went out fighting. And when the battle's over, there'll be all the time in the world to drift along the wind and find the atoms that used to be Hester, and my mother in the sage lands, and my sweethearts, all my sweethearts. Lyra, child, you rest when this is done, you hear? Life is good, and death is over.
His voice faded. She wanted to put her arms around him, but of course that was impossible. So she just looked at his pale form instead, and the ghost saw the passion and brilliance in her eyes and took strength from it. And on Lyra's shoulder and on Will's rode the two Gallivespians. Their short lives were nearly over. Each of them felt a stiffness in their limbs, a coldness around the heart. They would both return soon to the world of the dead, this time as ghosts, but they caught each other's eye and vowed that they would stay with Will and Lyra for as long as they could, and not say a word about their dying. Up and up the children clambered. They didn't speak. They heard each other's harsh breathing, they heard their footfalls, they heard the little stones their steps dislodged. Ahead of them all the way, the harpy scrambled heavily, her wings dragging, her claws scratching, silent and grim. Then came a new sound, a regular drip, drip, echoing in the tunnel. And then a faster dripping, a trickle, a running of water.
Here,
said Lyra, reaching forwards to touch a sheet of rock that blocked the way, smooth and wet and cold.
Here it is.
She turned to the harpy.
I've been thinking how you saved me, and how you promised to guide all the other ghosts that'll come through the world of the dead to that land we slept in last night. And I thought, if you ain't got a name, that can't be right, not for the future. So I thought I'd give you a name. Like King Yorick Bernison gave me my name, Silvertongue. I'm going to call you Gracious Wings. So that's your name now, and that's what you'll be forevermore. Gracious Wings.
One day, I will see you again, Lyra Silvertongue.
And if I know you're here, I shan't be afraid. Goodbye, Gracious Wings, till I die.
She embraced the harpy, hugging her tightly and kissing her on both cheeks. Then the Chevalier Tialis said,
This is the world of Lord Asriel's Republic?
Yes, that's what the alethiometer says. It's close to his fortress.
Then let me speak to the ghosts.
She held him high, and he called,
Listen, because the Lady Salmakia and I are the only ones among us who have seen this world before. There is a fortress on a mountaintop. That is what Lord Asriel is defending. Who the enemy is, I do not know. Lyra and Will have only one task now, which is to search for their demons. Our task is to help them. Let's be of good courage and fight well.
Lyra turned to Will.
All right, I'm ready.
He took out the knife and looked into the eyes of his father's ghost, who stood close by. They wouldn't know each other for much longer, and Will thought how glad he would have been to see his mother beside them as well, all three together.
Will!
He stopped. The knife was stuck in the air. He took his hand away, and there it hung, fastened in the substance of an invisible world. He let out a deep breath.
I
could see. Look at me, Will.
In the ghost light, he saw her bright hair, her firm-set mouth, her candid eyes. He felt the warmth of her breath. He caught the friendly scent of her flesh. The knife came loose.
I'll try again.
He turned away. Focusing hard, he let his mind flow down to the knife tip, touching, withdrawing, searching. And then he found it. In, along, down, and back. The ghosts crowded so close that Will's body and Lyra's felt little jolts of cold along every nerve. And he made the final cut. The first thing they sensed was noise. The light that struck in was dazzling, and they had to cover their eyes, ghosts and living alike, so they could see nothing for several seconds. But the pounding, the explosions, the rattle of gunfire, the shouts and screams were all instantly clear and horribly frightening. John Parry's ghost and the ghost of Lee Scoresby recovered their senses first. Because both had been soldiers, experienced in battle, they weren't so disoriented by the noise. Will and Lyra simply watched in fear and amazement. Explosive rockets were bursting in the air above, showering fragments of rock and metal over the slopes of the mountain, which they saw a little way off. And in the skies, angels were fighting angels. And witches, too, swooped and soared, screaming their clan cries as they shot arrows at their enemies. They saw a Gallivespian, mounted on a dragonfly, diving to attack a flying machine whose human pilot tried to fight him off, hand to hand. While the dragonfly darted and skimmed above, its rider leapt off to clamp his spurs deep in the pilot's neck. And then the insect returned, swooping low to let its rider leap on the brilliant green back as the flying machine droned straight into the rocks at the foot of the fortress.
"Open it wider!"
said Lee Scoresby.
"Let us out!"
"Wait, Lee,"
said John Parry.
"Something's happening. Look over there."
Will cut another small window in the direction he indicated, and as they looked out, they could all see a change in the pattern of the fighting. The attacking force began to withdraw. A group of armed vehicles stopped moving forwards, and under covering fire, turned laboriously and moved back. A squadron of flying machines, which had been getting the better of a ragged battle with Lord Asriel's gyropters, wheeled in the sky and made off to the west. The kingdom's forces on the ground, columns of riflemen, troops equipped with flamethrowers, with poison-spraying cannons, with weapons such as none of the Watchers had ever seen, began to disengage and pull back.
"What's going on? They're leaving the field. But why?"
There seemed to be no reason for it. Lord Asriel's allies were outnumbered, their weapons were less potent, and many more of them were lying wounded. Then Will felt a sudden movement among the ghosts. They were pointing out at something drifting in the air.
"Spectres! That's the reason."
And for the first time, Will and Lyra thought they could see those things, like veils of shimmering gauze, falling from the sky like thistledown. But they were very faint, and when they reached the ground, they were much harder to see.
"What are they doing?"
"They're making for that platoon of Asriel's riflemen."
And Will and Lyra knew what would happen, and they called out in fear.
"Run!
Get away!"
Some of the soldiers, hearing children's voices crying out from close by, looked around, startled. Others, seeing a spectre making for them, so strange and blank and greedy, raised their guns and fired, but of course with no effect. And then it struck the first man it came to. He was a soldier from Lyra's own world, an African. His demon was a long-legged, tawny cat spotted with black, and she drew back her teeth and prepared to spring. They all saw the man aiming his rifle, fearless, not giving an inch, and then they saw the demon in the toils of an invisible net, snarling, howling, helpless, and the man trying to reach to her, dropping his rifle, crying her name, and sinking and fainting himself with pain and brutal nausea.
"Right, Will,"
said John Parry.
"Let us out now. We can fight those things."
So Will opened the window wide and ran out at the head of the army of ghosts. And then began the strangest battle he could imagine. The ghosts clambered out of the earth, pale forms paler still in the midday light. They had nothing to fear anymore, and they threw themselves against the invisible spectres, grappling and wrestling and tearing at things Will and Lyra couldn't see at all. The riflemen and the other living allies were bemused. They could make nothing of this ghostly, spectral combat. Will made his way through the middle of it, brandishing the knife, remembering how the spectres had fled from it before. Wherever he went, Lyra went too, wishing she had something to fight with as Will was doing, but looking around, watching more widely. She thought she could see the spectres from time to time in an oily glistening of the air, and it was Lyra who felt the first shiver of danger. With Salmakia on her shoulder, she found herself on a slight rise, just a bank of earth surmounted by hawthorn bushes, from which she could see the great sweep of country the invaders were laying waste. The sun was above her. Ahead on the western horizon, clouds lay heaped and brilliant, riven with chasms of darkness, their tops drawn out in the high-altitude winds. That way, too, on the plain, the enemy's ground forces waited. Machines glinting brightly, flags astir with colour, regiments drawn up, waiting. Behind, and to her left, was the ridge of jagged hills leading up to the fortress. They shone bright grey in the lurid pre-storm light, and on the distant ramparts of black basalt she could even see little figures moving about, repairing the damaged battlements, bringing more weapons to bear, or simply watching. And it was about then that Lyra felt the first distant lurch of nausea, pain and fear that was the unmistakable touch of the spectres. She knew what it was at once, though she'd never felt it before, and it told her two things. First, that she must have grown up enough now to become vulnerable to the spectres, and secondly, that Pan must be somewhere close by.
Will! Will!
He heard her and turned, knife in hand and eyes ablaze. But before he could speak, he gave a gasp, made a choking lurch, and clutched his breast, and she knew the same thing was happening to him.
Pan! Pan!
She cried, standing on tiptoe to look all around. Will was bending over, trying not to be sick. After a few moments, the feeling passed away as if their demons had escaped. But they were no nearer to finding them, and all around the air was full of gunshots, cries, voices crying in pain or terror, the distant yowk, yowk, yowk of cliff ghasts circling overhead, the occasional whizz and thock of arrows, and then a new sound, the rising of the wind. Lyra felt it first on her cheeks, and then she saw the grass bending under it, and then she heard it in the hawthorns. The sky ahead was huge with storm. All the whiteness had gone from the thunderheads, and they rolled and swirled with sulphur yellow, sea green, smoke grey, oil black, a queasy churning miles high and as wide as the horizon. Behind her the sun was still shining, so that every grove and every single tree between her and the storm blazed ardent and vivid, little frail things defying the dark with leaf and twig and fruit and flower. And through it all went the two no longer quite children, seeing the spectres almost clearly now. The wind was snapping at Will's eyes and lashing Lyra's hair across her face, and it should have been able to blow the spectres away, but the things drifted straight down through it towards the ground. Boy and girl, hand in hand, picked their way over the dead and the wounded, Lyra calling for her demon, Will alert in every sense for his. And now the sky was laced with lightning, and then the first almighty crack of thunder hit their eardrums like an axe. Lyra put her hands to her head, and Will nearly stumbled as if driven downwards by the sound. They clung to each other and looked up, and saw a sight no one had ever seen before in any of the millions of worlds. Witches, Rutaskadi's clan, and Reina Mitis, and half a dozen others, every single witch carrying a torch of flaring pitch pine dipped in bitumen, were streaming over the fortress from the east, from the last of the clear sky, and flying straight towards the storm. Those on the ground could hear the roar and crackle as the volatile hydrocarbons flamed high above. A few spectres still remained in the upper airs, and some witches flew into them unseeing to cry out and tumble blazing to the ground. But most of the pallid things had reached the earth by this time, and the great flight of witches streamed like a river of fire into the heart of the storm. A flight of angels, armed with spears and swords, had emerged from the clouded mountain to meet the witches head-on. They had the wind behind them, and they sped forwards faster than arrows. But the witches were equal to that, and the first ones soared up high and then dived into the ranks of the angels, lashing to left and right with their flaring torches. Angel after angel, outlined in fire, their wings ablaze, tumbled screaming from the air. And then the first great drops of rain came down. If the commander in the storm clouds meant to douse the witch fires, he was disappointed. The pitch pine and the bitumen blazed defiance at it, spitting and hissing more loudly as more rain splashed into them. The raindrops hit the ground as if they'd been hurled in malice, breaking and splashing up into the air. Within a minute, Lyra and Will were both soaked to the skin and shaking with cold, and the rain stung their heads and arms like tiny stones. Through it all they stumbled and struggled, wiping the water from their eyes, calling in the tumult.
Pan! Pan!
Pan!
The thunder overhead was almost constant now, ripping and grinding and crashing as if the very atoms were being torn open. Between thunder crash and pang of fear ran Will and Lyra, howling, both of them.
Pan! My pantalaimon, Pan!
From Lyra, and a wordless cry from Will, who knew what he had lost but not what she was named. With them everywhere went the two Gallivespians, warning them to look this way, to go that way, watching out for the spectres the children could still not fully see. But Lyra had to hold Salmakia in her hands because the lady had little strength left to cling to Lyra's shoulder. Tialis was scanning the skies all around, searching for his kindred and calling out whenever he saw a needle-bright darting movement through the air above. But his voice had lost much of its power, and in any case the other Gallivespians were looking for the clan colours of their two dragonflies, the electric blue and the red and yellow. And those colours had long since faded, and the bodies that had shone with them lay in the world of the dead. And then came a movement in the sky that was different from the rest. As the children looked up, sheltering their eyes from the lashing raindrops, they saw an aircraft unlike any they'd seen before, ungainly, six-legged, dark, and totally silent. It was flying low, very low, from the fortress. It skimmed overhead, no higher than a rooftop above them, and then moved away into the heart of the storm. But they had no time to wonder about it, because another head-wrenching throb of nausea told Lyra that Pan was in danger again. And then Will felt it too, and they stumbled blindly through the puddles and the mud and the chaos of wounded men and fighting ghosts, helpless, terrified, and sick. Chapter 30. The Clouded Mountain.
Far off, the imperial heaven extended wide in circuit, undetermined square or round, with opal towers and battlements adorned of living sapphire. John Milton.
The intention craft was being piloted by Mrs. Coulter. She and her demon were alone in the cockpit. The barometric altimeter was little use in the storm, but she could judge her altitude roughly by watching the fires on the ground that blazed where angels fell. Despite the hurtling rain, they were still flaring high. As for the course, that wasn't difficult either. The lightning that flickered around the mountain served as a brilliant beacon, but she had to avoid the various flying beings who were still fighting in the air and keep clear of the rising land below. She didn't use the lights, because she wanted to get close and find somewhere to land before they saw her and shot her down. As she flew closer, the updrafts became more violent, the gusts more sudden and brutal. A gyropter would have had no chance. The savage air would have slammed it to the ground like a fly. In the intention craft, she could move lightly with the wind, adjusting her balance like a wave rider in the peaceable ocean. Cautiously, she began to climb, peering forward, ignoring the instruments and flying by sight and by instinct. Her demon leapt from one side of the little glass cabin to the other, looking ahead, above, to the left and right, and calling to her constantly. The lightning, great sheets and lances of brilliance, flared and cracked above and around the machine. Through it all, she flew in the little aircraft, gaining height little by little, and always moving on towards the cloud-hung palace. And as Mrs. Coulter approached, she found her attention dazzled and bewildered by the nature of the mountain itself. It reminded her of a certain abominable heresy, whose author was now deservedly languishing in the dungeons of the consistorial court. He had suggested that there were more spatial dimensions than the three familiar ones, that on a very small scale there were up to 7 or 8 other dimensions, but that they were impossible to examine directly. He had even constructed a model to show how they might work, and Mrs. Coulter had seen the object before it was exorcised and burned. Folds within folds, corners and edges both containing and being contained, its inside was everywhere and its outside was everywhere else. The clouded mountain affected her in a similar way. It was less like a rock than like a force field, manipulating space itself to enfold and stretch and layer it into galleries and terraces, chambers and colonnades and watchtowers of air and light and vapour. She felt a strange exultation welling slowly in her breast, and she saw at the same time how to bring the aircraft safely up to the clouded terrace on the southern flank. The little craft lurched and strained in the turbid air, but she held the course firm, and her demon guided her down to land on the terrace. The light she'd seen by till now had come from the lightning, the occasional gashes in the cloud where the sun struck through, the fires from the burning angels, the beams of Anbaric searchlights, but the light here was different. It came from the substance of the mountain itself, which glowed and faded in a slow, breath-like rhythm with a mother-of-pearl radiance. Woman and demon got down from the craft and looked around to see which way they should go. She had the feeling that other beings were moving rapidly above and below, speeding through the substance of the mountain itself with messages, orders, information. She couldn't see them, All she could see was confusing, infolded perspectives of colonnade, staircase, terrace and façade. Before she could make up her mind which way to go, she heard voices and withdrew behind a column. The voices were singing a psalm and coming closer, and then she saw a procession of angels carrying a litter. As they neared the place where she was hiding, they saw the intention craft and stopped. The singing faltered, and some of the bearers looked around in doubt and fear. Mrs. Coulter was close enough to see the being in the litter. An angel, she thought, and indescribably aged. He wasn't easy to see, because the litter was enclosed all around with crystal that glittered and threw back the enveloping light of the mountain, but she had the impression of terrifying decrepitude, of a face sunken in wrinkles, of trembling hands, and of a mumbling mouth and rheumy eyes. The aged being gestured shakily at the intention craft, and cackled and muttered to himself, plucking incessantly at his beard, and then threw back his head and uttered a howl of such anguish that Mrs. Coulter had to cover her ears. But evidently the bearers had a task to do, for they gathered themselves and moved further along the terrace, ignoring the cries and mumbles from inside the litter. When they reached an open space, they spread their wings wide, and at a word from their leader they began to fly, carrying the litter between them, until they were lost to Mrs. Coulter's sight in the swirling vapours. But there wasn't time to think about that. She and the golden monkey moved on quickly, climbing great staircases, crossing bridges, always moving upward. The higher they went, the more they felt that sense of invisible activity all around them, until finally they turned a corner into a wide space like a mist-hung piazza and found themselves confronted by an angel with a spear.
"Who are you? What is your business?"
he said. Mrs. Coulter looked at him curiously. These were the beings who had fallen in love with human women, with the daughters of men, so long ago.
"No, no, please, don't waste time. Take me to the regent at once. He's waiting for me."
Disconcert them, she thought, keep them off balance. And this angel did not know what he should do, so he did as she told him. She followed him for some minutes, through those confusing perspectives of light, until they came to an antechamber. How they had entered, she didn't know, but there they were, and after a brief pause, something in front of her opened like a door. Her demon's sharp nails were pressing into the flesh of her upper arms, and she gripped his fur for reassurance. Facing them was a being made of light. He was man-shaped, man-sized, she thought, but she was too dazzled to see. The golden monkey hid his face in her shoulder, and she threw up an arm to hide her eyes. Metatron said,
"Where is she? Where is your daughter?"
"I've come to tell you, my Lord Regent."
"If she was in your power, you would have brought her."
"She is not, but her demon is."
"How can that be?"
"I swear, Metatron, her demon is in my power. Please, great Regent, hide yourself a little. My eyes are dazzled."
He drew a veil of cloud in front of himself. Now it was like looking at the sun through smoked glass, and her eyes could see him more clearly, though she still pretended to be dazzled by his face. He was exactly like a man in early middle age, tall, powerful, and commanding. Was he clothed? Did he have wings? She couldn't tell because of the force of his eyes. She could look at nothing else.
"Please, Metatron, hear me. I have just come from Lord Asriel. He has the child's demon, and he knows that the child will soon come to search for him."
"What does he want with the child?"
"To keep her from you until she comes of age. He doesn't know where I've gone, and I must go back to him soon. I'm telling you the truth. Look at me, great Regent, as I can't easily look at you. Look at me clearly, and tell me what you see."
The Prince of the Angels looked at her. It was the most searching examination Marisa Coulter had ever undergone. Every scrap of shelter and deceit was stripped away, and she stood naked, body and ghost and demon together, under the ferocity of Metatron's gaze. And she knew that her nature would have to answer for her, and she was terrified that what he saw in her would be insufficient. Lyra had lied to Yoffo Arachnason with her words. Her mother was lying with her whole life.
"Yes, I see."
"What do you see?"
"Corruption and envy and lust for power. Cruelty and coldness. A vicious, probing curiosity. Pure, poisonous, toxic malice. You have never, from your earliest years, shown a shred of compassion or sympathy or kindness without calculating how it would return to your advantage. You have tortured and killed without regret or hesitation. You have betrayed and intrigued and gloried in your treachery. You are a cesspit of moral filth.
That voice, delivering that judgment, shook Mrs. Coulter profoundly. She knew it was coming and she'd readied it, and yet she hoped for it too, and now that it had been said, she felt a little gush of triumph. She moved closer to him.
So you see, I can betray him easily. I can lead you to where he's taking my daughter's demon, and you can destroy Azrael, and the child will walk unsuspecting into your hands.
She felt the movement of vapor about her, and her senses became confused. His next words pierced her flesh like darts of scented ice.
When I was a man, I had wives in plenty, but none was as lovely as you.
When you were a man?
When I was a man, I was known as Enoch, the son of Jared, the son of Mahalalel, the son of Kenan, the son of Enosh, the son of Seth, the son of Adam. I lived on Earth for 65 years, and then the Authority took me to his kingdom.
And you had many wives?
I loved their flesh, and I understood it when the sons of heaven fell in love with the daughters of Earth, and I pleaded their cause with the Authority. But his heart was fixed against them, and he made me prophesy their doom.
And you have not known a wife for thousands of years?
I have been regent of the kingdom.
And is it not time you had a consort?
That was the moment she felt most exposed and in most danger. But she trusted to her flesh and to the strange truth she'd learned about angels, perhaps especially those angels who had once been human. Lacking flesh, they coveted it and longed for contact with it. And Metatron was close now, close enough to smell the perfume of her hair and to gaze at the texture of her skin, close enough to touch her with scalding hands. There was a strange sound, like the murmur and crackle you hear before you realize that what you're hearing is your house on fire.
Tell me what Lord Azrael is doing and where he is.
I can take you to him now.
The angels carrying the litter left the clouded mountain and flew south. Metatron's orders had been to take the Authority to a place of safety away from the battlefield, because he wanted him kept alive for a while yet. But rather than give him a bodyguard of many regiments, which would only attract the enemy's attention, he had trusted to the obscurity of the storm, calculating that in these circumstances a small party would be safer than a large one. And so it might have been, if a certain Cliff Ghast, busy feasting on a half-dead warrior, had not looked up just as a random searchlight caught the side of the crystal litter. Something stirred in the Cliff Ghast's memory. He paused, one hand on the warm lever, and as his brother knocked him aside, the recollection of a babbling Arctic fox came to his mind. At once he spread his leathery wings and bounded upward, and a moment later the rest of the troop followed. Zaphania and her angels had searched diligently all the night and some of the morning, and finally they had found a minute crack in the mountainside to the south of the fortress, which had not been there the day before. They had explored it and enlarged it, and now Lord Azrael was climbing down into a series of caverns and tunnels extending a long way below the fortress. It wasn't totally dark, as he'd thought. There was a faint source of illumination, like a stream of billions of tiny particles faintly glowing. They flowed steadily down the tunnel like a river of light.
Dust,
he said to his demon. He had never seen it with the naked eye, but then he had never seen so much dust together. He moved on until, quite suddenly, the tunnel opened out, and he found himself at the top of a vast cavern, a vault immense enough to contain a dozen cathedrals. There was no floor. The sides sloped vertiginously down towards the edge of a great pit, hundreds of feet below, and darker than darkness itself, and into the pit streamed the endless dustfall, pouring ceaselessly down. Its billions of particles were like the stars of every galaxy in the sky, and every one of them was a little fragment of conscious thought. It was a melancholy light to see by. He climbed with his demon down towards the abyss, and as they went, they gradually began to see what was happening along the far side of the gulf, hundreds of yards away in the gloom. He had thought there was a movement there, and the farther down he climbed, the more clearly it resolved itself. A procession of dim, pale figures picking their way along the perilous slope, men, women, children, beings of every kind he had seen and many he had not. Intent on keeping their balance, they ignored him altogether, and Lord Asriel felt the hair stir at the back of his neck. when he realized that they were ghosts.
Lyra came here,
he said quietly to the snow leopard.
Tread carefully,
was all she said in reply. Will and Lyra were soaked through, shivering, racked with pain and stumbling blindly through mud and over rocks and into little gullies where storm-fed streams ran red with blood. Lyra was afraid that the Lady Salmakia was dying. She hadn't uttered a word for several minutes, and she lay faint and limp in Lyra's hand. As they sheltered in one riverbed where the water was white, at least, and scooped up handfuls to their thirsty mouths, Will felt Tialis rouse himself and say,
Will, I can hear horses coming. Lord Asriel has no cavalry. It must be the enemy. Get across the stream and hide. I saw some bushes that way.
Come on,
said Will to Lyra, and they splashed through the icy, bone-aching water and scrambled up the far side of the gully just in time. The riders who came over the slope and clattered down to drink didn't look like cavalry. They seemed to be of the same kind of close-haired flesh as their horses, and they had neither clothes nor harness. They carried weapons, though, tridents, nets, and scimitars. Will and Lyra didn't stop to look. They stumbled over the rough ground at a crouch, intent only on getting away unseen. But they had to keep their heads low to see where they were treading and avoid twisting an ankle or worse, and thunder exploded overhead as they ran, so they couldn't hear the screeching and snarling of the cliff ghasts until they were upon them. The creatures were surrounding something that lay glittering in the mud, something slightly taller than they were, which lay on its side, a large cage, perhaps, with walls of crystal. They were hammering at it with fists and rocks, shrieking and yelling. And before Will and Lyra could stop and run the other way, they had stumbled right into the middle of the troop. Chapter 31 Authority's End.
For empire is no more, and now the lion and wolf shall cease. William Blake.
Mrs. Coulter whispered to the shadow beside her.
Look how he hides, Metatron. He creeps through the dark like a rat.
They stood on a ledge high up in the great cavern, watching Lord Asriel and the snow leopard make their careful way down, a long way below.
I could strike him now.
Yes, of course you could. But I want to see his face, dear Metatron. I want him to know I've betrayed him. Come, let's follow and catch him.
The dust fall shone like a great pillar of faint light as it descended smoothly and never-endingly into the gulf. Mrs. Coulter had no attention to spare for it, because the shadow beside her was trembling with desire, and she had to keep him by her side, under what control she could manage. They moved down, silent, following Lord Asriel. The farther down they climbed, the more she felt a great weariness fall over her.
What? What?
Whispered the shadow, feeling her emotions and suspicious at once.
I was thinking, how glad I am that the child will never grow up to love and be loved. I thought I loved her when she was a baby, but now...
There was regret. In your heart, there was regret that you will not see her grow up.
Oh, Metatron, how long it is since you were a man. Can you really not tell what it is I'm regretting? It's not her coming of age, but mine. How bitterly I regret that I didn't know of you in my own girlhood. How passionately I would have devoted myself to you.
She leaned towards the shadow as if she couldn't control the impulses of her own body, and the shadow hungrily sniffed and seemed to gulp at the scent of her flesh. They were moving laboriously over the tumbled and broken rocks towards the foot of the slope. The further down they went, the more the dust light gave everything a nimbus of golden mist. Mrs. Coulter kept reaching for where his hand might have been if the shadow had been a human companion, and then seemed to recollect herself, and whispered,
Keep behind me, Metatron. Wait here. Asriel is suspicious. Let me lull him first. When he's off guard, I'll call you, but come as a shadow in this small form so he doesn't see you. Otherwise, he'll just let the child's demon fly away.
The regent was a being whose profound intellect had had thousands of years to deepen and strengthen itself, and whose knowledge extended over a million universes. Nevertheless, at that moment he was blinded by his twin obsessions, to destroy Lyra and to possess her mother. He nodded and stayed where he was, while the woman and the monkey moved forward as quietly as they could. Lord Asriel was waiting behind a great block of granite, out of sight of the regent. The snow leopard heard them coming, and Lord Asriel stood up as Mrs. Coulter came around the corner. Everything, every surface, every cubic centimetre of air, was permeated by the falling dust, which gave a soft clarity to every tiny detail. And in the dust light, Lord Asriel saw that her face was wet with tears, and that she was gritting her teeth so as not to sob. He took her in his arms, and the golden monkey embraced the snow leopard's neck and buried his black face in her fur.
Is Lyra safe? Has she found her demon?
The ghost of the boy's father is protecting both of them.
Dust is beautiful. I never knew.
What did you tell him?
I lied and lied, Asriel. Let's not wait too long. I can't bear it. We won't live, will we? We won't survive like the ghosts.
Not if we fall into the abyss. We came here to give Lyra time to find her demon, and then time to live and grow up. If we take Metatron to extinction, Marisa, she'll have that time. And if we go with him, it doesn't matter.
And Lyra will be safe?
Yes. Yes.
He kissed her. She felt as soft and light in his arms as she had when Lyra was conceived 13 years before. She was sobbing quietly. When she could speak, she whispered,
I told him I was going to betray you and betray Lyra, and he believed me, because I was corrupt and full of wickedness. He looked so deep I felt sure he'd see the truth, but I lied too well. I was lying with every nerve and fibre and everything I'd ever done. I wanted him to find no good in me, and he didn't. There is none. But I love Lyra. Where did this love come from? I don't know. It came to me like a thief in the night. And now I love her so much, my heart is bursting with it. All I could hope was that my crimes were so monstrous that the love was no bigger than a mustard seed in the shadow of them. And I wished I'd committed even greater ones to hide it more deeply still. But the mustard seed had taken root and was growing. And the little green shoot was splitting my heart wide open. And I was so afraid he'd see.
She had to stop to gather herself. He stroked her shining hair, all set about with golden dust, and waited.
Any moment now he'll lose patience,
she whispered.
I told him to make himself small. But he's only an angel after all, even if he was once a man. And we can wrestle with him and bring him to the edge of the gulf. And we'll both go down with him.
He kissed her.
Yes, Lyra will be safe. And the kingdom will be powerless against her. Call him now, Marisa, my love.
She took a deep breath and let it out in a long, shuddering sigh. Then she smoothed her skirt down over her thighs and tucked the hair back behind her ears.
Metatron, it's time.
Metatron's shadow-cloaked form appeared out of the golden air and took in at once what was happening. The two demons, crouching and watchful, the woman with the nimbus of dust, and Lord Asriel, who leapt at him at once, seizing him around the waist and tried to hurl him to the ground. The angel's arms were free, though, and with fists, palms, elbows, knuckles, forearms, he battered Lord Asriel's head and body. Great pummeling blows that forced the breath from his lungs and rebounded from his ribs, that cracked against his skull and shook his senses. However, his arms encircled the angel's wings, cramping them to his side. And a moment later, Mrs. Coulter had leapt up between those pinioned wings and seized Metatron's hair. His strength was enormous. It was like holding the mane of a bolting horse. As he shook his head furiously, she was flung this way and that, and she felt the power in the great folded wings as they strained and heaved the man's arms locked so tightly around them. The demons had seized hold of him, too. Stelmaria had her teeth firmly in his leg, and the golden monkey was tearing at one of the edges of the nearest wing, snapping feathers, ripping at the veins, and this only roused the angel to greater fury. With a sudden, massive effort, he flung himself sideways, freeing one wing and crushing Mrs. Coulter against a rock. Mrs. Coulter was stunned for a second, and her hands came loose. At once the angel reared up again, beating his one free wing to fling off the golden monkey. But Lord Asriel's arms were firm around him still, and in fact the man had a better grip now there wasn't so much to enclose. Lord Asriel set himself to crushing the breath out of Metatron, grinding his ribs together, and trying to ignore the savage blows that were landing on his skull and his neck. But those blows were beginning to tell. And as Lord Asriel tried to keep his footing on the broken rocks, something shattering happened to the back of his head. When he flung himself sideways, Metatron had seized a fist-sized rock, and now he brought it down with brutal force on the point of Lord Asriel's skull. A man felt the bones of his head move against each other, and he knew that another blow like that would kill him outright. Dizzy with pain, pain that was worse for the pressure of his head against the angel's side, he still clung fast, the fingers of his right hand crushing the bones of his left, and stumbled for a footing among the fractured rocks. And as Metatron raised the bloody stone high, a golden furred shape sprang up like a flame leaping to a treetop, and the monkey sank his teeth into the angel's hand. The rock came loose and clattered down towards the edge, and Metatron swept his arm to left and right, trying to dislodge the demon. But the golden monkey clung with teeth, claws, and tail, and then Mrs. Coulter gathered the great white beating wing to herself and smothered its movement. Metatron was hampered, but he still wasn't hurt. Nor was he near the edge of the abyss. And by now Lord Asriel was weakening. He was holding fast to his blood-soaked consciousness, but with every movement a little more was lost. He could feel the edges of the bones grinding together in his skull. He could hear them. His senses were disordered. All he knew was hold tight and drag down. Then Mrs. Coulter found the angel's face under her hand, and she dug her fingers deep into his eyes. Metatron cried out. From far off across the great cavern, echoes answered, and his voice bounded from cliff to cliff, doubling and diminishing and causing those distant ghosts to pause in their endless procession and look up. And Stelmaria, the snow leopard demon, her own consciousness dimming with Lord Asriel's, made one last effort and leapt for the angel's throat. Metatron fell to his knees. Mrs. Coulter, falling with him, saw the blood-filled eyes of Lord Asriel gaze at her. And she scrambled up, hand over hand, forcing the beating wing aside, and seized the angel's hair to wrench back his head and bare his throat for the snow leopard's teeth. And now Lord Asriel was dragging him backwards, feet stumbling and rocks falling, and the golden monkey was leaping down with them, snapping and scratching and tearing, and they were almost there, almost at the edge. But Metatron forced himself up, and with a last effort spread both wings wide, a great white canopy that beat down and down and down, again and again and again, and then Mrs. Coulter had fallen away, and Metatron was upright, and the wings beat harder and harder, and he was aloft, he was leaving the ground, with Lord Asriel still clinging tight, but weakening fast. The golden monkey's fingers were entwined in the angel's hair, and he would never let go. But they were over the edge of the abyss. They were rising, and if they flew higher, Lord Asriel would fall, and Metatron would escape.
Marisa! Marisa!
The cry was torn from Lord Asriel, and with the snow leopard beside her, with a roaring in her ears, Lyra's mother stood and found her footing and leapt with all her heart to hurl herself against the angel and her demon and her dying lover, and seize those beating wings and bear them all down together into the abyss. The cliff ghasts heard Lyra's exclamation of dismay, and their flat heads all snapped around at once. Will sprang forward and slashed the knife at the nearest of them. He felt a little kick on his shoulder as Tialis leapt off and landed on the cheek of the biggest, seizing her hair and kicking hard below the jaw before she could throw him off. The creature howled and thrashed as she fell into the mud, and the nearest one looked stupidly at the stump of his arm, and then in horror at his own ankle, which his sliced-off hand had seized as it fell. A second later the knife was in his breast. Will felt the handle jump three or four times with the dying heartbeats and pulled it out before the cliff ghast could twist it away in falling. He heard the others cry and shriek in hatred as they fled, and he knew that Lyra was unhurt beside him. But he threw himself down in the mud with only one thing in his mind.
"Tialis! Tialis!"
he cried, and avoiding the snapping teeth, he hauled the biggest cliff ghast's head aside. Tialis was dead, his spurs deep in her neck. The creature was kicking and biting still, so he cut off her head and rolled it away before lifting the dead Galavispian clear of the leathery neck.
"Will,"
said Lyra behind him.
"Will, look at this."
She was gazing into the crystal litter. It was unbroken, although the crystal was stained and smeared with mud and the blood from what the cliff ghasts had been eating before they found it. It lay tilted crazily among the rocks, and inside it...
"Oh, Will, he's still alive. The poor thing."
Will saw her hands pressing against the crystal, trying to reach in to the angel and comfort him. Because he was so old, and he was terrified, crying like a baby and cowering away into the lowest corner.
"He must be so old. I've never seen anyone suffering like that. Oh, Will, can't we let him out?"
Will cut through the crystal in one movement and reached in to help the angel out. Demented and powerless, the aged being could only weep and mumble in fear and pain and misery, and he shrank away from what seemed like yet another threat.
"It's all right. We can help you hide, at least. Come on, we won't hurt you."
The shaking hand seized his and feebly held on. The old one was uttering a wordless, groaning whimper that went on, and grinding his teeth and compulsively plucking at himself with his free hand. But as Lyra reached in, too, to help him out, he tried to smile and to bow, and his ancient eyes, deep in their wrinkles, blinked at her with innocent wonder. Between them they helped the Ancient of Days out of his crystal cell. It wasn't hard, for he was as light as paper, and he would have followed them anywhere, having no will of his own, and responding to simple kindness like a flower to the sun. But in the open air there was nothing to stop the wind from damaging him, and to their dismay his form began to loosen and dissolve. Only a few moments later he had vanished completely, and their last impression was of those eyes, blinking in wonder, and a sigh of the most profound and exhausted relief. Then he was gone, a mystery dissolving in mystery. It had all taken less than a minute, and Will turned back at once to the fallen Chevalier. He picked up the little body, cradling it in his palms, and found his tears flowing fast.
Will, we've got to move. We've got to. The lady can hear those horses coming.
Out of the indigo sky, an indigo hawk swooped low, and Lyra cried out and ducked. But Salmakia cried with all her strength.
No, Lyra! No! Stand high and hold out your fist!
So Lyra held still, supporting one arm with the other, and the blue hawk wheeled and turned and swooped again to seize her knuckles in sharp claws. On the hawk's back sat a grey-haired lady, whose clear-eyed face looked first at Lyra, then at Salmakia clinging to her collar.
Madame,
said Salmakia,
we have done. You have done all you need. Now we are here,
said Madame Oxenteel, and twitched the reins. At once the hawk screamed three times, so loud that Lyra's head rang. In response there darted from the sky first one, then two and three and more, then hundreds of brilliant warrior-bearing dragonflies, all skimming so fast it seemed they were bound to crash into one another. But the reflexes of the insects and the skills of their riders were so acute that instead they seemed to weave a tapestry of swift and silent needle-bright colour over and around the children.
Lyra,
said the lady on the hawk,
and Will, follow us now, and we shall take you to your demons.
As the hawk spread its wings and lifted away from one hand, Lyra felt the little weight of Salmakia fall into the other, and knew in a moment that only the lady's strength of mind had kept her alive this long. She cradled her body close and ran with Will under the cloud of dragonflies, stumbling and falling more than once, but holding the lady gently against her heart all the time.
Left! Left!
Cried the voice from the blue hawk. And in the lightning-riven murk they turned that way. And to their right Will saw a body of men in light grey armour, helmeted, masked, their grey wolf-demons padding in step beside them. A stream of dragonflies made for them at once, and the men faltered. Their guns were no use, and the Gallivespians were among them in a moment, each warrior springing from his insect's back, finding a hand, an arm, a bare neck, and plunging his spur in before leaping back to the insect as it wheeled and skimmed past again. They were so quick it was almost impossible to follow. The soldiers turned and fled in panic, their discipline shattered. But then came hoofbeats in a sudden thunder from behind, and the children turned in dismay. Those horse people were bearing down on them at a gallop, and already one or two had nets in their hands, whirling them around over their heads and entrapping the dragonflies to snap the nets like whips and fling the broken insects aside.
This way,
came the lady's voice.
Duck now! Get down low!
They did, and felt the earth shake under them. Could that be hoofbeats? Lyra raised her head and wiped the wet hair from her eyes and saw something quite different from horses.
Yorick! Oh, Yorick!
Will pulled her down again at once, for not only Yorick Birnison, but a regiment of his bears were making directly for them. Just in time Lyra tucked her head down, and then Yorick bounded over them, roaring orders to his bears to go left, go right, and crush the enemy between them. Lightly, as if his armour weighed no more than his fur, the Bear King spun to face Will and Lyra, who were struggling upright.
Yorick! Behind you, they've got nets!
Will cried, because the riders were almost on them. Before the bear could move, a rider's net hissed through the air, and instantly Yorick was enveloped in steel-strong cobweb. He roared, rearing high, slashing with huge paws at the rider. But the net was strong, and although the horse whinnied and reared back in fear, Yorick couldn't fight free of the coils.
Yorick, keep still, don't move!
He scrambled forward through the puddles and over the tussocks as the rider tried to control the horse, and reached Yorick just at the moment when a second rider arrived and another net hissed through the air. But Will kept his head. Instead of slashing wildly and getting in more of a tangle, he watched the flow of the net and cut it through in a matter of moments. The second net fell useless to the ground, and then Will leapt at Yorick, feeling with his left hand, cutting with his right. The great bear stood motionless as the boy darted here and there over his vast body, cutting, freeing, clearing the way.
Now go!
Will yelled, leaping clear, and Yorick seemed to explode upwards, full into the chest of the nearest horse. The rider had raised his scimitar to sweep down at the bear's neck, but Yorick Birnison in his armour weighed nearly 2 tons, and nothing at that range could withstand him. Horse and rider, both of them smashed and shattered, fell harmlessly aside. Yorick gathered his balance, looked around to see how the land lay, and roared to the children,
"On my back! No!"
Lyra leapt up, and Will followed. Pressing the cold iron between their legs, they felt the massive surge of power as Yorick began to move. Behind them, the rest of the bears were engaging with the strange cavalry, helped by the Gallivespians, whose stings enraged the horses. The lady on the blue hawk skimmed low and called,
"Straight ahead now, among the trees in the valley!"
Yorick reached the top of a little rise in the ground and paused. Ahead of them, the broken ground sloped down towards a grove about a quarter of a mile away. Somewhere beyond that, a battery of great guns was firing shell after shell, howling high overhead, and someone was firing flares, too, that burst just under the clouds and drifted down towards the trees, making them blaze with cold green light as a fine target for the guns. And fighting for control of the grove itself were a score or more spectres, being held back by a ragged band of ghosts. As soon as they saw that little group of trees, Lyra and Will both knew that their demons were in there, and that if they didn't reach them soon, they would die. More spectres were arriving there every minute, streaming over the ridge from the right. Will and Lyra could see them very clearly now. An explosion just over the ridge shook the ground and flung stones and clods of earth high into the air. Lyra cried out, and Will had to clutch his chest.
"Hold on!"
Yorick growled, and began to charge. A flare burst high above, and another, drifting slowly downwards with a magnesium-bright glare. Another shell burst, closer this time, and they felt the shock of the air and a second or two later the sting of earth and stones on their faces. Yorick didn't falter, but they found it hard to hold on. They couldn't dig their fingers into his fur. They had to grip the armour between their knees, and his back was so broad that both of them kept slipping.
"Look!"
cried Lyra, pointing up as another shell burst nearby. A dozen witches were making for the flares, carrying thick-leaved bushy branches, and with them they brushed the glaring lights aside, sweeping them away into the sky beyond. Darkness fell over the grove again, hiding it from the guns. And now the grove was only a few yards away. Will and Lyra both felt their missing selves close by, an excitement, a wild hope chilled with fear, because the spectres were thick among the trees and they would have to go in directly among them, and the very sight of them evoked that nauseating weakness at the heart.
"They're afraid of the knife,"
said a voice beside them, and the Bear King stopped so suddenly that Will and Lyra tumbled off his back.
"Lee, Lee, my comrade, I have never seen this before. You are dead. What am I speaking to?"
"Yorick, old fella, you don't know the half of it. We'll take over now. The spectres aren't afraid of bears. Lyra, Will, come this way, and hold up that knife."
The blue hawk swooped once more to Lyra's fist, and the grey-haired lady said,
"Don't waste a second. Go in and find your demons and escape. There's more danger coming."
"Thank you, lady. Thank you all,"
said Lyra, and the hawk took wing. Will could see Lee Scoresby's ghost dimly beside them, urging them into the grove, but they had to say farewell to Yorick Birnison.
"Yorick, my dear, there ain't words. Bless you, bless you."
"Thank you, King Yorick," said Will.
"No time. Go, go."
He pushed them away with his armoured head. Will plunged after Lee Scoresby's ghost into the undergrowth, slashing to left and right with the knife. The light here was broken and muted, and the shadows were thick, tangled, confusing.
"Keep close,"
he called to Lyra, and then cried out as a bramble sliced across his cheek. All around them there was movement, noise and struggle. The shadows moved to and fro like branches in a high wind. They might have been ghosts. Both children felt the little dashes of cold they knew so well. Then they heard voices all around.
"This way!
Over here! Keep going! We're holding them off!
Not far now!"
And then came a cry in a voice that Lyra knew and loved better than any other.
"Oh, come quick! Quick! Lyra!"
"Pam, darling, I'm here!"
She hurled herself into the dark, sobbing and shaking, and Will tore down branches and ivy and slashed at brambles and nettles, while all around them the ghost voices rose in a clamour of encouragement and warning. But the spectres had found their target too, and they pressed in through the snagging tangle of bush and briar and root and branch, meeting no more resistance than smoke. A dozen, a score of the pallid malignities seemed to pour in towards the centre of the grove, where John Parry's ghost marshalled his companions to fight them off. Will and Lyra were both trembling and weak with fear, exhaustion, nausea and pain, but giving up was inconceivable. Lyra tore at the brambles with her bare hands. Will slashed and hacked to left and right, as around them the combat of the shadowy beings became more and more savage.
There! See 'em? By that big rock!
A wildcat. Two wildcats, spitting and hissing and slashing. Both were demons, and Will felt that if there were time, he'd easily be able to tell which was Pantalaimon. But there wasn't time, because a spectre eased horribly out of the nearest patch of shadow and glided towards the demons. Will leapt over the last obstacle, a fallen tree trunk, and plunged the knife into the unresisting shimmer in the air. He felt his arm go numb, but he clenched his teeth as he was clenching his fingers around the hilt, and the pale form seemed to boil away and melt back into the darkness again. Almost there. And the demons were mad with fear, because more spectres and still more came pressing through the trees, and only the valiant ghosts were holding them back.
"Can you cut through?"
said John Parry's ghost. Will held up the knife, and had to stop as a racking bout of nausea shook him from head to toe. There was nothing left in his stomach, and the spasm hurt dreadfully. Lyra beside him was in the same state. Lee's ghost, seeing why, leapt for the demons and wrestled with the pale thing that was coming through the rock from behind them.
"Will, please!"
In went the knife, along, down, back. Lee Scoresby's ghost looked through and saw a wide, quiet prairie under a brilliant moon, so very like his own homeland that he thought he'd been blessed. Will leapt across the clearing and seized the nearest demon while Lyra scooped up the other. And even in that horrible urgency, even at that moment of utmost peril, each of them felt the same little shock of excitement. For Lyra was holding Will's demon, the nameless wildcat, and Will was carrying Pantalaimon. They tore their glance away from each other's eyes.
"Goodbye, Mr. Scoresby!"
Lyra cried, looking around for him.
"I wish... Oh, thank you! Thank you! Goodbye!"
"Goodbye, my dear child. Goodbye, Will. Go well."
Lyra scrambled through, but Will stood still and looked into the eyes of his father's ghost, brilliant in the shadows. Before he left him, there was something he had to say.
"You said I was a warrior. You told me that was my nature and I shouldn't argue with it. Father, you were wrong. I fought because I had to. I can't choose my nature, but I can choose what I do. And I will choose. Because now, I'm free."
His father's smile was full of pride and tenderness.
"Well done, my boy. Well done indeed."
Will couldn't see him anymore. He turned and climbed through after Lyra. And now that their purpose was achieved, now the children had found their demons and escaped, the dead warriors allowed their atoms to relax and drift apart, at long, long last. Out of the little grove, away from the baffled spectres, out of the valley, past the mighty form of his old companion, the armor-clad bear, the last little scrap of the consciousness that had been the aeronaut Lee Scoresby floated upwards, just as his great balloon had done so many times. Untroubled by the flares and the bursting shells, deaf to the explosions and the shouts and cries of anger and warning and pain, conscious only of his movement upwards, the last of Lee Scoresby passed through the heavy clouds and came out under the brilliant stars, where the atoms of his beloved demon, Hester, were waiting for him. Chapter 32. Morning.
The morning comes, the night decays, the watchmen leave their stations. William Blake.
The wide, golden prairie that Lee Scoresby's ghost had seen briefly through the window was lying quiet under the first sun of morning. Golden, but also yellow, brown, green, and every one of the million shades between them. And black in places, in lines and streaks of bright pitch. And silvery, too, where the sun caught the tops of a particular kind of grass just coming into flower. And blue, where a wide lake some way off and a small pond closer by reflected back the wide blue of the sky. And quiet, but not silent, for a soft breeze rustled the billions of little stems, and a billion insects and other small creatures scraped and hummed and chirruped in the grass. And a bird, too high in the blue to be seen, sang little looping falls of bell notes, now close by, now far off, and never twice the same. In all that wide landscape, the only living things that were silent and still were the boy and the girl lying asleep, back to back, under the shade of an outcrop of rock at the top of a little bluff. They were so still, so pale, that they might have been dead. Hunger had drawn the skin over their faces, pain had left lines around their eyes, and they were covered in dust and mud and not a little blood. And from the absolute passivity of their limbs, they seemed in the last stages of exhaustion. Lyra was the first to wake. As the sun moved up the sky, it came past the rock above and touched her hair, and she began to stir, and when the sunlight reached her eyelids, she found herself pulled up from the depths of sleep like a fish, slow and heavy and resistant. But there was no arguing with the sun, and presently she moved her head and threw her arm across her eyes and murmured,
"Pan! Pan!"
Under the shadow of her arm, she opened her eyes and came properly awake. She didn't move for some time because her arms and legs were so sore, and every part of her body felt limp with weariness. But still she was awake, and she felt the little breeze and the sun's warmth, and she heard the little insect scrapings and the bell song of that bird high above. It was all good. She had forgotten how good the world was. Presently she rolled over and saw Will, still fast asleep. His hand had bled a lot, his shirt was ripped and filthy, his hair was stiff with dust and sweat. She looked at him for a long time, at the little pulse in his throat, at his chest rising and falling slowly, at the delicate shadows his eyelashes made when the sun finally reached them. He murmured something and stirred. Not wanting to be caught looking at him, she looked the other way at the little grave they'd dug the night before, just a couple of hand spans wide, where the bodies of the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia now lay at rest. There was a flat stone nearby. She got up and prized it loose from the soil, and set it upright at the head of the grave, and then sat up and shaded her eyes to gaze across the plain. It seemed to stretch forever and ever. It was nowhere entirely flat. Gentle undulations and little ridges and gullies varied the surface wherever she looked, and here and there she saw a stand of trees so tall they seemed to be constructed rather than grown. Their straight trunks and dark green canopy seemed to defy distance, being so clearly visible at what must have been many miles away. Closer, though, in fact at the foot of the bluff, not more than 100 yards away, there was a little pond fed by a spring coming out of the rock, and Lyra realized how thirsty she was. She got up on shaky legs and walked slowly down towards it. The spring gurgled and trickled through mossy rocks, and she dipped her hands in it again and again, washing them clear of the mud and grime before lifting the water to her mouth. It was teeth-achingly cold, and she swallowed it with delight. The pond was fringed with reeds, where a frog was croaking. It was shallow and warmer than the spring, as she discovered when she took off her shoes and waded into it. She stood for a long time with the sun on her head and her body, relishing the cool mud under her feet and the cold flow of spring water around her calves. She bent down to dip her face under the water and wet her hair thoroughly, letting it trail out and flicking it back again, stirring it with her fingers to lift all the dust and grime out. When she felt a little cleaner and her thirst was satisfied, she looked up the slope again to see that Will was awake. He was sitting with his knees drawn up and his arms across them, looking out across the plain as she'd done and marvelling at the extent of it, and at the light, and at the warmth, and at the quiet. She climbed slowly back to join him, and found him cutting the names of the Gallivespians on the little headstone, and setting it more firmly in the soil.
"Are they?"
he said, and she knew he meant the demons.
"Don't know. I haven't seen Pan. I got the feeling he's not far away, but I don't know. Do you remember what happened?"
He rubbed his eyes and yawned so deeply she heard little cracking noises in his jaw. Then he blinked and shook his head.
"Not much. I picked up Pantalaimon, and you picked up the other one, and we came through. And it was moonlight everywhere. And I put him down to close the window."
"And you're the other demon just jumped out of my arms. And I was trying to see Mr. Scoresby through the window, and Yorick, and to see where Pan had gone. And when I looked around, they just weren't there."
"It doesn't feel like when we went into the world of the dead, though. Like when we were really separated."
"No. They're somewhere near, all right. I remember when we were young, we used to try and play hide-and-seek, except it never really worked, because I was too big to hide from him, and I always used to know exactly where he was, even if he was camouflaged as a moth or something. But this is strange,"
she said, passing her hands over her head involuntarily as if she were trying to dispel some enchantment.
He ain't here, but I don't feel torn apart. I feel safe, and I know he is.
They're together, I think.
Yeah, they must be.
He stood up suddenly.
Look, over there.
He was shading his eyes and pointing. She followed his gaze and saw a distant tremor of movement, quite different from the shimmer of the heat haze.
Animals?
And listen,
he said, putting his hand behind his ear. Now he'd pointed it out, she could hear a low, persistent rumble, almost like thunder, a very long way off.
They've disappeared.
The little patch of moving shadows had vanished, but the rumble went on for a few moments. Then it became suddenly quieter, though it had been very quiet already. The two of them were still gazing in the same direction, and shortly afterwards they saw the movement start up again. And a few moments later came the sound.
They went behind a ridge or something. Are they closer?
Can't really see. Yes, they're turning, look. They're coming this way.
Well, if we have to fight them, I want a drink first,
said Will, and he took the rucksack down to the stream, where he drank deep and washed off most of the dirt. His wound had bled a lot. He was a mess. He longed for a hot shower with plenty of soap and for some clean clothes. Lyra was watching the... whatever they were. They were very strange.
Will, they're riding on wheels.
Will climbed back a little way up the slope and shaded his eyes to look. It was possible to see individuals now. The group, or herd, or gang, was about a dozen strong, and they were moving, as Lyra said, on wheels. They looked like a cross between antelopes and motorcycles, but they were stranger than that, even. They had trunks like small elephants. And they were making for Will and Lyra, with an air of intention. Will took out the knife, but Lyra, sitting on the grass beside him, was already turning the hands of the alethiometer. It responded quickly, while the creatures were still a few hundred yards away. The needle darted swiftly left and right, and left and left, and Lyra felt her mind dart to the meanings and land on them as lightly as a bird.
They're friendly. It's all right, Will. They're looking for us. They knew we were here. And it's odd. I can't quite make it out. Dr. Malone?
She said the name half to herself, because she couldn't believe Dr. Malone would be in this world. Still, the alethiometer indicated her clearly, although of course it couldn't give her name. Lyra put it away and stood up slowly beside Will.
I think we should go down to them. They ain't gonna hurt us.
Some of them had stopped, waiting. The leader moved ahead a little, trunk raised, and they could see how he propelled himself with powerful backward strokes of his lateral limbs. Some of the creatures had gone to the pond to drink. The others waited, but not with the mild, passive curiosity of cows gathering at a gate. These were individuals, lively with intelligence and purpose. They were people. Will and Lyra moved down the slope until they were close enough to speak to them. In spite of what Lyra had said, Will kept his hand on the knife.
I don't know if you understand me, but I know you're friendly. I think we should...
The leader moved his trunk and said,
Come see Mary. You ride. We carry. Come see Mary.
Oh!
She turned to Will, smiling with delight. Two of the creatures were fitted with bridles and stirrups of braided cord. Not saddles. Their diamond-shaped backs turned out to be comfortable enough without them. Lyra had ridden a bear, and Will had ridden a bicycle, but neither had ridden a horse, which was the closest comparison. However, riders of horses are usually in control, and the children soon found that they were not. The reins and the stirrups were there simply to give them something to hold on to and balance with. The creatures themselves made all the decisions.
Where are...
Will began to say, but had to stop and regain his balance as the creature moved under him. The group swung around and moved down the slight slope, going slowly through the grass. The movement was bumpy but not uncomfortable, because the creatures had no spine. Will and Lyra felt that they were sitting on chairs with a well-sprung seat. Soon they came to what they hadn't seen clearly from the bluff, one of those patches of black or dark brown ground. And they were as surprised to find roads of smooth rock lacing through the prairie as Mary Malone had been some time before. The creatures rolled onto the surface and set off, soon picking up speed. The road was more like a watercourse than a highway. In places it broadened into wide areas like small lakes, and at others it split into narrow channels only to combine again unpredictably. It was quite unlike the brutal, rational way roads in Will's world sliced through hillsides and leapt across valleys on bridges of concrete. This was part of the landscape, not an imposition on it. They were going faster and faster. It took Will and Lyra a while to get used to the living impulse of the muscles and the shuddering thunder of the hard wheels on the hard stone. Lyra found it more difficult than Will at first, because she had never ridden a bicycle, and she didn't know the trick of leaning into the corner. But she saw how he was doing it, and soon she was finding the speed exhilarating. The wheels made too much noise for them to speak. Instead, they had to point at the trees, in amazement at their size and splendor. At a flock of birds, the strangest they had ever seen, their fore and aft wings giving them a twisting, screwing motion through the air. At a fat blue lizard as long as a horse, basking in the very middle of the road, the wheeled creatures divided to ride on either side of it, and it took no notice at all. The sun was high in the sky when they began to slow down. And in the air, unmistakable, was the salt smell of the sea. The road was rising towards a bluff, and presently they were moving no faster than a walk. Lyra, stiff and sore, said,
"Can you stop? I want to get off and walk."
Her creature felt the tug at the bridle, and whether or not he understood her words, he came to a halt. Will's did, too, and both children climbed down, finding themselves stiff and shaken after the continued jolting and tensing. The creatures wheeled around to talk together, their trunks moving elegantly in time with the sounds they made. After a minute they moved on, and Will and Lyra were happy to walk among the hay-scented, grass-warm creatures who trundled beside them. One or two had gone on ahead to the top of the rise, and the children, now that they no longer had to concentrate on hanging on, were able to watch how they moved and admire the grace and power with which they propelled themselves forwards and leaned and turned. As they came to the top of the rise, they stopped, and Will and Lyra heard the leader say,
"Mary close, Mary there."
They looked down. On the horizon there was the blue gleam of the sea. A broad, slow-moving river wound through rich grassland in the middle distance, and at the foot of the long slope, among copses of small trees and rows of vegetables, stood a village of thatched houses. More creatures like these moved about among the houses, or tended crops, or worked among the trees.
"Now ride again," said the leader.
There wasn't far to go. Will and Lyra climbed up once more, and the other creatures looked closely at their balance and checked the stirrups with their trunks, as if to make sure they were safe. Then they set off, beating the road with their lateral limbs and urging themselves forward down the slope until they were moving at a terrific pace. Will and Lyra clung tight with hands and knees. They felt the air whip past their faces, flinging their hair back and pressing on their eyeballs. The thundering of the wheels, the rush of the grassland on either side, the sure and powerful lean into the broad curve ahead, the clear-headed rapture of speed. The creatures loved this, and Will and Lyra felt their joy and laughed in happy response. They stopped in the center of the village, and the others, who had seen them coming, gathered around, raising their trunks and speaking words of welcome. And then Lyra cried,
"Dr. Malone!"
Mary had come out of one of the huts, her faded blue shirt, her stocky figure, her warm, ruddy cheeks both strange and familiar. Lyra ran and embraced her, and the woman hugged her tight, and Will stood back, careful and doubtful. Mary kissed Lyra warmly, and then came forward to welcome Will. And then came a curious little mental dance of sympathy and awkwardness, which took place in a second or less. Moved by compassion for the state they were in, Mary first meant to embrace him as well as Lyra. But Mary was grown up, and Will was nearly grown, and she could see that that kind of response would have made a child of him, because while she might have embraced a child, she would never have done that to a man she didn't know. So she drew back mentally, wanting above all to honour this friend of Lyra's, and not cause him to lose face. So instead, she held out her hand and he shook it, and a current of understanding and respect passed between them, so powerful that it became liking at once, and each of them felt that they had made a lifelong friend, as indeed they had.
"This is Will. He's from your world. Remember, I told you about him."
"I'm Mary Malone, and you're hungry. The pair of you, you look half-starved."
She turned to the creature by her side and spoke some of those singing, hooting sounds, moving her arm as she did so. At once the creatures moved away, and some of them brought cushions and rugs from the nearest house and laid them on the firm soil under a tree nearby, whose dense leaves and low-hanging branches gave a cool and fragrant shade. And as soon as they were comfortable, Their hosts brought smooth wooden bowls brimming with milk, which had a faint lemony astringency and was wonderfully refreshing, and small nuts like hazels, but with a richer buttery taste, and salad plucked fresh from the soil, sharp, peppery leaves mingled with soft, thick ones that oozed a creamy sap, and little cherry-sized roots tasting like sweet carrots. But they couldn't eat much. It was too rich. Will wanted to do justice to their generosity, but the only thing he could easily swallow, apart from the drink, was some flat, slightly scorched, floury bread like chapatis or tortillas. It was plain and nourishing, and that was all Will could cope with. Lyra tried some of everything, but like Will, she soon found that a little was quite enough. Mary managed to avoid asking any questions. These two had passed through an experience that had marked them deeply. They didn't want to talk about it yet. So she answered their questions about the Mulefa, and told them briefly how she had arrived in this world. And then she left them under the shade of the tree, because she could see their eyelids drooping and their heads nodding.
You don't have to do anything now but sleep.
The afternoon air was warm and still, and the shade of the tree was drowsy and murmurous with crickets. Less than 5 minutes after they'd swallowed the last of the drink, both Will and Lyra were fast asleep.
They are of two sexes?
Said Atal, surprised.
But how can you tell?
It's easy,
said Mary.
Their bodies are different shapes. They move differently.
They are not much smaller than you, but they have less sraf. When will that come to them?
I don't know. I suppose sometime soon. I don't know when it happens to us.
No wheels,
said Atal sympathetically. They were weeding the vegetable garden. Mary had made a hoe to save having to bend down. Atal used her trunk, so their conversation was intermittent.
But you knew they were coming?
Yes.
Was it the sticks that told you?
No,
said Mary, blushing. She was a scientist. It was bad enough to have to admit to consulting the I Ching, but this was even more embarrassing.
It was a night picture,
she confessed. The Mulefa had no single word for dream. They dreamed vividly, though, and took their dreams very seriously.
You don't like night pictures?
Yes, I do, but I didn't believe them until now. I saw the boy and the girl so clearly, and a voice told me to prepare for them.
What sort of voice? How did it speak, if you couldn't see it?
It was hard for Atal to imagine speech without the trunk movements that clarified and defined it. She'd stopped in the middle of a row of beans and faced Mary with fascinated curiosity.
Well, I did see it. It was a woman, or a female wise one, like us, like my people, but very old, and yet not old at all.
Wise one was what the Mulefa called their leaders. She saw that Atal was looking intensely interested.
How could she be old and also not old?
It is a make-like.
Atal swung her trunk, reassured. Mary went on as best she could.
She told me that I should expect the children, and when they would appear and where, but not why. I must just look after them.
They are hurt and tired. Will they stop the sraf leaving?
Mary looked up uneasily. She knew without having to check through the spyglass that the shadow particles were streaming away faster than ever.
I hope so, but I don't know how.
In the early evening, when the cooking fires were lit and the first stars were coming out, a group of strangers arrived. Mary was washing. She heard the thunder of their wheels and the agitated murmur of their talk, and hurried out of her house, drying herself. Will and Lyra had been asleep all afternoon, and they were just stirring now, hearing the noise. Lyra sat up groggily to see Mary talking to five or six of the Mulefa, who were surrounding her, clearly excited. But whether they were angry or joyful, she couldn't tell. Mary saw her and broke away.
Lyra, something's happened. They found something they can't explain, and it's... I don't know what it is. I've got to go and look. It's an hour or so away. I'll come back as soon as I can. Help yourself to anything you need from my house. I can't stop. They're too anxious.
All right,
said Lyra, still dazed from her long sleep. Mary looked under the tree. Will was rubbing his eyes.
I really won't be too long. Atal will stay with you.
The leader was impatient. Mary swiftly threw her bridle and stirrups over his back, excusing herself for being clumsy, and mounted at once. They wheeled and turned and drove away into the dusk. They set off in a new direction, along the ridge above the coast to the north. Mary had never ridden in the dark before, and she found the speed even more alarming than by day. As they climbed, she could see the glitter of the moon on the sea far off to the left, and its silver sepia light seemed to envelop her in a cool, skeptical wonder. The wonder was in her, and the skepticism was in the world, and the coolness was in both. She looked up from time to time and touched the spyglass in her pocket, but she couldn't use it till they'd stopped moving, and these Mulefa were moving urgently with the air of not wanting to stop for anything. After an hour's hard riding, they swung inland, leaving the stone road and moving slowly along a trail of beaten earth that ran between knee-high grass past a stand of wheel trees and up towards a ridge. The landscape glowed under the moon. Wide, bare hills with occasional little gullies where streams trickled down among the trees that clustered there. It was towards one of these gullies that they led her. She had dismounted when they left the road, and she walked steadily at their pace over the brow of the hill and down into the gully. She heard the trickling of the spring and the night wind in the grass. She heard the quiet sound of the wheels crunching over the hard-packed earth, and she heard the Mulefa ahead of her murmuring to one another, and then they stopped. In the side of the hill, just a few yards away, was one of those openings made by the subtle knife. It was like the mouth of a cave, because the moonlight shone into it a little way, just as if inside the opening there were the inside of the hill. But it wasn't, and out of it was coming a procession of ghosts. Mary felt as if the ground had given way beneath her mind. She caught herself with a start, seizing the nearest branch for reassurance that there still was a physical world and she was still part of it. She moved closer. Old men and women, children, babes in arms, humans and other beings too, more and more thickly they came out of the dark into the world of solid moonlight and vanished. That was the strangest thing. They took a few steps in the world of grass and air and silver light and looked around, their faces transformed with joy. Mary had never seen such joy, and held out their arms as if they were embracing the whole universe. And then, as if they were made of mist or smoke, they simply drifted away, becoming part of the earth and the dew and the night breeze. Some of them came towards Mary as if they wanted to tell her something, and reached out their hands, and she felt their touch like little shocks of cold. One of the ghosts, an old woman, beckoned, urging her to come close. Then she spoke, and Mary heard her say,
"Tell them stories. They need the truth. You must tell them true stories, and everything will be well. Just tell them stories."
That was all, and then she was gone. It was one of those moments when we suddenly recall a dream that we've unaccountably forgotten, and back in a flood comes all the emotion we felt in our sleep. It was the dream she'd tried to describe to Atal, the night picture. But as Mary tried to find it again, it dissolved and drifted apart, just as these presences did in the open air. The dream was gone. All that was left was the sweetness of that feeling and the injunction to tell them stories. She looked into the darkness. As far as she could see into that endless silence, more of these ghosts were coming, thousands upon thousands, like refugees returning to their homeland.
"Tell them stories,"
she said to herself. Chapter 33. Marzipan.
Sweet spring, full of sweet days and roses, a box where sweets compacted lie. George Herbert.
Next morning, Lyra woke up from a dream in which Pantalaimon had come back to her and revealed his final shape, and she had loved it, but now she had no idea what it was. The sun hadn't long risen, and the air had a fresh bloom. She could see the sunlight through the open door of the little thatched hut she slept in, Mary's house. She lay for a while listening. There were birds outside, and some kind of cricket, and Mary was breathing quietly in her sleep nearby. Lyra sat up and found herself naked. She was indignant for a moment, and then she saw some clean clothes folded beside her on the floor, a shirt of Mary's, a length of soft, light, patterned cloth that she could tie into a skirt. She put them on, feeling swamped in the shirt, but at least decent. She left the hut. Pantalaimon was nearby. She was sure of it. She could almost hear him talking and laughing. It must mean that he was safe, and they were still connected somehow. And when he forgave her and came back, the hours they'd spend just talking, just telling each other everything. Will was still asleep under the shelter tree, the lazy thing. Lyra thought of waking him up, but if she was on her own, she could swim in the river. She happily used to swim naked in the River Charwell with all the other Oxford children, but it would be quite different with Will, and she blushed even to think of it. So she went down to the water alone in the pearl-coloured morning. Among the reeds at the edge there was a tall, slender bird like a heron, standing perfectly still on one leg. She walked quietly and slowly so as not to disturb it, but the bird took no more notice of her than if she'd been a twig on the water.
"Well,"
she said. She left the clothes on the bank and slipped into the river. It was seawater coming in on the tide, and it was strange to Lyra, who had never swum in salt water before. She swam hard to keep warm, and then came out and huddled on the bank, shivering. Pan would help dry her normally. Was he a fish laughing at her from under the water? Or a beetle creeping into the clothes to tickle her? Or a bird? Or was he somewhere else entirely with the other demon, and with Lyra not on his mind at all? The sun was warm now, and she was soon dry. She dressed in Mary's loose shirt again, and, seeing some flat stones by the bank, went to fetch her own clothes to wash them. But she found that someone had already done that. Hers and Will's, too, were laid over the springy twigs of a fragrant bush, nearly dry. Will was stirring. She sat nearby and called him.
"Will, wake up."
"Where are we?"
he said at once, and sat up, reaching for the knife.
"Safe,"
she said, looking away.
"And they washed our clothes, too. Or Dr. Malone did. I'll get yours. They're nearly dry."
She passed them in through the curtain of leaves and sat with her back to him till he was dressed.
"I swam in the river. I went to look for Pan, but I think he's hiding."
"That's a good idea. I mean a swim. I feel as if I've got years and years of dirt on me. I'll go down and wash."
While he was gone, Lyra wandered around the village, not looking too closely at anything in case she broke some code of politeness, but curious about everything she saw. Some of the houses were very old and some quite new, but they were all built in much the same way out of wood and clay and thatch. There was nothing crude about them. Each door and window frame and lintel was covered in subtle patterns, but patterns that weren't carved in the wood. It was as if they'd persuaded the wood to grow in that shape naturally. The more she looked, the more she saw all kinds of order and carefulness in the village, like the layers of meaning in the alethiometer. Part of her mind was eager to puzzle it all out, to step lightly from similarity to similarity, from one meaning to another, as she did with the instrument. But another part was wondering how long they'd be able to stay here before they had to move on. "Well, I'm not going anywhere till Pan comes back," she said to herself. Presently Will came up from the river, and then Mary came out of her house and offered them breakfast. And soon Atal came along too, and the village came to life around them. The young Mulefa children, without wheels, kept peeping around the edges of their houses to stare, and Lyra would suddenly turn and look at them directly to make them jump and laugh with terror.
"Well, now,"
Mary said when they'd eaten some bread and fruit and drunk a scalding infusion of something like mint.
"Yesterday you were too tired and all you could do was rest. But you look a lot more lively today, both of you. And I think we need to tell each other everything we've found out. And it'll take us a good long time. And we might as well keep our hands busy while we're doing it. So we'll make ourselves useful and mend some nets."
They carried the pile of stiff, tarry netting to the riverbank and spread it out on the grass, and Mary showed them how to knot a new piece of cord where it was worn. She was wary, because Atal had told her that the families further along the coast had seen large numbers of the tualapi, the white birds, gathering out at sea, and everyone was prepared for a warning to leave at once. But work had to go on in the meantime. So they sat working in the sun by the placid river, and Lyra told her story, from the moment so long ago when she and Pan decided to look in the retiring room at Jordan College. The tide came in and turned, and still there was no sign of the tualapi. In the late afternoon, Mary took Will and Lyra along the river bank, past the fishing posts where the nets were tied, and through the wide salt marsh towards the sea. It was safe to go there when the tide was out, because the white birds only came inland when the water was high. Mary led the way along a hard path above the mud. Like many things the Mulefa had made, it was ancient and perfectly maintained, more like a part of nature than something imposed on it.
Did they make the stone roads?
No. I think the roads made them, in a way. I mean, they'd never have developed the use of the wheels if there hadn't been plenty of hard, flat surfaces to use them on. I think they're lava flows from ancient volcanoes. So the roads made it possible for them to use the wheels. And other things came together as well, like the wheel trees themselves and the way their bodies are formed. They're not vertebrates. They don't have a spine. Some lucky chance in our worlds long ago must have meant that creatures with backbones had it a bit easier. So all kinds of other shapes developed, all based on the central spine. In this world, chance went another way, and the diamond frame was successful. There are vertebrates, to be sure, but not many. There are snakes, for example. Snakes are important here. The people look after them and try not to hurt them. Anyway, their shape and the roads and the wheel trees coming together all made it possible. A lot of little chances all coming together. When did your part of the story begin, Will?
Lots of little chances for me, too,
he began, thinking of the cat under the hornbeam trees. If he'd arrived there 30 seconds earlier or later, he would never have seen the cat, never have found the window, never have discovered Chitagatsi and Lyra. None of this would have happened.